Welcome to the Carpcast. Introducing the two biggest nods that don't use chops. They're old, grumpy, and they're pretty opinionated. Here's your hosts, it's Mark and Jamie.
So hello and welcome to a very fine year, episode 66 of the Carpcast. Happy New Year, Mark.
Yeah, thank you. Happy New Year yourself. Did Santa bring you what you wanted? Did he empty his sack for you?
I was waiting for that joke. I knew it'd come from you.
Am I that predictable?
Yeah. Did he? Yeah. You don't get many presents when you get to my age, but I did get a couple of things I wanted: a new pair of pajamas, some slipper socks I had to buy myself, some aftershave. Any fishing presents? No. Only what I treated myself to just before Christmas. Had a whopping great order off Nash. Some of the new carbon bank sticks and some fizzing stick mix and a few bits and bobs. Fourth scope rod for all the sneaking around this year. A few bits and bobs. I need two reels though. I'm two reels short of from a scopey setup.
But, what are you going to go for?
Not sure. I mean, I've already got three of the Fox FX11s. I use the Shimano Magtex for me, like my main rods are chucking rods, on me whatever the Nash chucking rods are, the ones after the Pursuits. I think they're called Pursuits again now, aren't they? But I've got the last version from a few years ago, which are still the best rods I've ever used.
Oh, the NRXDs.
That's it, yeah, NRXDs.
I think they have like NR Toros now.
I've got a
You're the Nash man, and I know more than you.
I think there's Toros. I'm sure the Extreme Pursuit or the Pursuits have come back. Not sure. I think Toros were the last ones, and there's now Pursuits. So I've got, yeah, NRXDs. But, I've got the Shimano's on them. And then I've got some Fox FX11s for my smaller rods. They're slightly on the big side for a smaller rod, but in fact, the FX9s might be a little bit better. I think Nash have got some pretty decent reels. They do some budget reels, Nash, that look really nice. Some like matte black ones that look really nice on the scopes. But I think they've got some better quality ones coming out. But if they're not out soon, then if they're not out this spring, then I'll probably just speak to one of the chaps at Fox and see if they'll sort me a deal out. Discount or something, you never know.
Yeah, but, you could even just pay for them like everyone else.
Yeah, well, they don't give you them free, that's for sure. But no, Scott Day's been really good to me in the past. He's always sorted us out a discount on a few bits. Although probably as good a discount as you can get anywhere these days is one of the many shops all competing with each other, doing price matches and all that. Quite often when I've had a trade price off someone, that you can find a shop or two doing it at a very similar price. One of them usually being Eric's, and we've had some sad news this week, haven't we, about the owner of Eric's, Sam, who's a friend and obviously business acquaintance with the Northern Angling Show. He's had a bad accident on Christmas Eve, a really bad accident. He apparently fell off a wall, it must have been a high wall, at home on Christmas Eve and was very badly injured, very serious. I know he was induced into a coma for a while. I believe he's not in a coma anymore and he's showing signs of improvement. I think he's conscious, which is amazing. Absolutely amazing. So it's looking good for his recovery. And nobody's really mentioned it much on the internet. I've seen a couple of posts about it. People, obviously hundreds and hundreds of people in the trade wishing him well, as we do. I was very sad over Christmas. I couldn't think, I was messaging Adam Snowden, who works there. I was messaging him, getting updates, and it was on my mind all the time. not just for the time of year, but Sam's a top guy, so obviously we wish him well, and speedy recovery. Hope he's all fit for the Northern Anglia show, because we normally have a night out on the Sunday night after the show's finished. A few of us go out on the lash, and Sam's been with us every year for the last few years, so I hope he's recovered in time for a night out then. Talking about Northern Anglia show, if you don't know anything about it, it's one of the finest, if not the finest show in Britain. Certainly the second biggest, with the big one being the biggest. But in 4 years, we are right on their heels. Had 10,000 visitors last year, hoping to grow that this year. We've doubled in size in the hall, gone from 7,000 metres to 15,000 metres. So we've doubled in size in the hall at the back. It's at Event City in Manchester. You can get tickets online at www.northernanglingshow.co.uk. There's loads of like VIP bundles. You can get them there's a Tracker one. They usually do one, like Tracker, CC Moore, there's a Bay Deal, there's a Nash one, there's a Diawa one. There's loads of VIP deals, and if you buy a ticket online, I think they're about the same price as buying them on the door, but it gets you into the show earlier. You can get in from 9 a.m, whereas if you're paying on the door, it's 10 a.m. Yeah, so check it out, northernanglishow.co.uk. Go and have a look at all the different tickets. There's a few different types on there. There's concessions for young'uns, and we're having a party on the Saturday evening in the venue, so you don't have to go anywhere. You can chill in the show and then hang about with some of your favourite anglers and have a few beers. There's going to be entertainment, music, and a right good social. If you're up for that one, Mark, the bit of a, we're trying to put the social element back in fishing.
I'll hack around for a shandy or two.
Yeah, sure, should be good fun, I think. Obviously the Carpcast stand will be there, won't it? We'll have a stand. We'll doing a very special deal on all our clothing. If you haven't yet got yourself a hoodie, t-shirt or a hat or whatever, I suggest you don't buy one now and you wait till the 1st and 2nd of April. And we'll be doing a very, very decent deal at the show. Along with other stuff, we're going to be selling bait on the stand. We've got a few bits and bobs. Come and check it out. Come and have a beer with us on the Saturday evening. Come and see all the celebrity anglers. We've got millions of people there, loads of new companies that have never been there before. It's going to be absolutely massive. Check that one out. Anything on the net, Mark?
It's on the net. It must be true.
There's a few things. I mean, we've not done one of these for a while. We've had a bit of a Christmas break, so I'm afraid we have to mention the sad death of 16-year-old Jack Morrison, whose body was found in the Kent Lake, and it was the day after he went fishing. No suspicious circumstances, and nothing to add. I'm going to speculate on what actually happened, but it just goes to remind us all, be careful out there, because we've all been that 16-year-old kid who just wanted to go fishing on his own and what have you. So, but what has come of this? Have you seen the Just Giving page that was started just to help the family out with Jack's funeral?
I did notice something about that, yeah.
I think it set a target of $7,000, and I'm going to see if I can find it up now, but off the top of my head, I think they've got over 16.
Wow.
Which, forget all your, rubbish and arguing and bitching that happens in the cart world. It is.
Yeah,
when a lovely bunch of people, and that just proves it. There's a, like I say, I know I've said it before, but there's so many brilliant people in carp fishing, a lot more than there isn't.
Yes, it's good when people come together. It's shame it happens in such a sad thing. We wish all our best to the family of Jack Morrison. I'm not 100% sure what happened. I know there was no suspicious circumstances, and I'm guessing it's, what do they call it when you fall into cold water? Is it a toxic shock or something? It can stop your heart, basically. And there was a well-known angler's friend was killed on New Year's Eve a few years ago. Fell out of a boat on Raysbury. Was there two of them killed?
I think they might have been in that occurrence, but it's sadly, it's something that is going to just happen and then happen again in a few years in different circumstances. It's sad, but water is dangerous stuff.
It is dangerous stuff, yeah, and we forget that sometimes with the young'uns, obviously, yeah. Be careful. I don't know if he was wading or if he was in a boat. I don't really know how he ended up in the water, but I'm guessing he was fully submerged. I would guess if he just fell in the edge wading, he might have been able to scramble out.
Who knows? He might have fallen over, banged his head. I don't think we should speculate.
No.
It's not constructive in any way, but, just while we're on this, I know I've done some ridiculously stupid things on the bank in the past, and I'm sure you have as well.
Maybe.
So,
maybe.
Skinny dipping, swimming your baits out.
Yeah. Yeah, I've done that. We spoke about Wim Hof, the Iceman, they call him, the guy that he trains his body using oxygen breathing techniques and cold water. And
cold exposure, submersion, yeah.
Yeah, I've been doing it every time I have a shower for a month or two now. I'll have a normal hot shower, get clean and everything, and then I'll blast it to cold. Now, obviously, living in the north of England with the temperatures we've had over the last few months, when you put it to cold, it's pretty damn cold at the minute. I started it at the back end of the summer, and it's definitely colder now. And it does put your body into, like, it's almost psychedelic. I mean, I only do it for, I've never done more than 20, 30 seconds.
Really?
No, I...
Is it all?
Well, you try doing it, and it's a lot, you can count to 10. It's the longest 10 you've ever you've ever tried, I can assure you. Well, you can try and count to 10, we go,
I'll tell you now. I'll tell you exactly. Because I've been doing the same for quite a bit longer than that, and I can stand in a cold shower for 5 minutes plus easy. But you're breathing first, or what have you, and you get the shower going. I don't do warm first.
You go straight
in the cold, but I just don't jump straight in. You kind of stood behind it, and I was like kicking my legs into it. Getting the initial shock there, and then just kind of like splashing myself a little bit with my hands around my upper body, and then it's just, you kind of almost acclimatise to it, then you just like walk in, and you're deep breathing through your initial shock of the cold, but then it gets to a point where it's just water, it's just not cold. Usually after about the 30 second minute mark, it is just it's just there, you get used to it. I mean, it's pretty much healed now, but I've had a bad shoulder for a while, and there's several occasions where I've just stood in the cold shower with it just blasting on my right shoulder, and it works wonders. I've got about 2 prescriptions downstairs for the doctor from anti-inflammatories, and I'm not taking pharmaceutical poison. Give me a cold shower and some Wim Hof breathing, I'm sorted.
I'll tell you what will be funny. Should we have a little the cold shower feature? What we do, most people on their phones have got some sort of audio recording facility. I use an app called Dictaphone. I think the free version, you can't actually export the audio file. But there must be ways to export as an MP3, depending what phone you have. So what I propose is, let's do a weekly feature. I want everybody to have a cold shower, a proper cold shower. Put the recorder on your phone. Just on the side in the bathroom, out the wet, set it recording and get under that cold shower. And I want to listen to I want to hear it. I'll kick off next week, but if you fancy doing that, send it in. And let's see who can last the longest, and no cheating. We'll know if you're under it, because you cannot mistake that cold water, and there's no way of faking it. We'll know, won't we, because it's pretty cold. But
what a bizarre perverted request.
It's not perverted.
You want to hear other men in the shower? What happens if someone sends you in a recording and all you can hear is What are you going to think?
It won't be going out on our show. Yeah, put it that way. But yeah, I want to see if everyone can get out. I mean, the side effect is it's supposed to be extremely good for you. I mean, you're saying it reduces inflammatory. It's used in a lot of the.
Go on. Well, I'll tell you about the first time I really did anything like that was on my 40th last year. We went for a swim in the sea at Iceland.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, you're not going to get much colder than that. I think the air temperature around the time was around 0 to +2, and the sea temperature was 0 to -2.
Wow.
And it was horrible. It was like you were being jabbed by a million pins and needles. I was in there for about 30 seconds. I did about 3 strokes of a swim, then I just got out, ran straight back into the geothermal hot tub. But it is so exhilarating. And for about a good 4 or 5 hours the rest of that day, I just felt like I had so much energy.
Yeah, it's supposed to give you more energy. Wim Hof reckons it can cure illnesses, serious illnesses. It's certainly good. Lots of severe athletes, high endurance athletes, use this cold water treatment, extreme hot to cold. The UFC fighters use it for healing and stuff. It's supposed to help with endurance, and it's actually quite psychedelic, I know. And even just my 30 seconds in the cold water after I've had a hot shower, you feel a bit spaced afterwards. What have you just sent me now? You sent me a picture of a naked woman in an ice pool.
Yeah, that's where I want to take a dip. No, there's ice. You're not going to be able to do anything, but it'd be nice.
Yeah.
I've just totally lost your thread now, haven't I?
Yeah. But yeah, it's, let's get all our listeners attempting the cold showers and, no wussing, no just turning the hot down a bit. You've got to go to full cold and stay under it. And if you fancy recording it, and we'll play the funny ones out, because there will be some funny ones, I can assure you. I might have a little go myself one day this week. I'm going to do it.
I'm going to be a bit boring because I can just do it now.
Doesn't shock you even when you first go in?
No, there's additional shock is there, but it is not. It's not painful. It's not. I can do it now. I've even done a few times. I've just filled the bath up to brim with cold water and just lowered myself and got in, and I don't even get goosebumps.
Wow.
Yeah.
And do you actually wash yourself in the cold water, or do you?
No, I have a hot shower to do all the washing stuff. That happens every Thursday.
Cool. I don't know where we've gone on this podcast, but we're all over the place at the minute.
Yeah, that's a good thing. We were doing on the net.
It's on the net. It must be true.
Yeah, more on the nets was Mark Bartlett winning the Angling Times Carp Angler of the Year.
Yeah, I've got to say, I think that's the correct decision they've made. He was it British, European and world champ all at the same time?
Yes.
It's quite an achievement. It's probably going to be a while before that's repeated by anybody from any nation.
We haven't had him on the show, have we?
No, we haven't. I think we might... track him down.
Stick him on the list. Yeah, obviously we can get his number. Rob Hughes, I'm sure, will supply us, and let's get some tips off him. He's obviously got a few skills.
Oh, just a bit. He's someone we can pick his brains and learn from. But speaking of Rob Hughes, have you been watching his On the Bank on BT Sport?
I've got them all recorded. I've not had a chance to sit down and watch him yet. I've not really watched any TV for quite some time.
I've watched them all. Are you using the little BT Sport app on my EE phone?
Ah, did you get it with the EE, did you?
I did, yeah. Yeah, I got it through that. And
I've got it and not used it yet. Can you watch them back on that? Can you see all the old ones?
Yeah, you can. If you go down to, other sports and then another sports thing, and then, the fishing's in there along with cricket, although I think we should be above cricket.
Is it good? You watched them? What's your impressions?
Yeah, my first impression, it does have a few similarities to what's the other one that Keith Arthur did? Tight Lines, yeah. You know, in the fact that they're in, you know, sat in a studio, but it's not a different guest every week. It's Rob Hughes and his mate Andy Ford, who's a fly fisherman, you know, chatting, having a bit of banter backwards and forwards, and then they have different features going out fishing on this. I don't want to give any spoilers away, but this latest one, it's quite interesting. Andy Ford was out, fishing. I think it was a River Dee in some grayling competition, which he fell in. I thought that was quite funny. But, it's all aspects of fishing, not just carping. They've been out sea fishing on this latest one as well. So there's something in there for everyone. It's recommended. Watch it. I order you.
I don't think we'll ever get an invite for our Carpcast TV debut. We've got a face for radio, so probably not.
Yeah. We do certainly have that face. It's better behind a microphone instead of in front of a camera.
We are available for public appearances.
Scaring children.
Yes. Anyway, moving on. There's something that I see you put in the notes about a very large cast.
It's on the net. It must be true. Yeah, I saw this because I think I just put it in. It's a 213-yard cast, which, it's further than I've ever cast. It's a damn good chuck. But Darren Greenfield has done it from a wheelchair. So, big up to Darren Greenfield. That is one hell of a chuck, hell of an achievement. And there was a picture. He's been out with Mark Hutchinson, and, there's someone like holding the wheelchair, anchoring him down, and he's proper bending into this cast, so
that's fantastic. I mean, there is zero chance of me ever casting 213 yards, able-bodied or not. So that's an amazing result. And I wonder how many lakes, somebody in a wheelchair can fish properly. Like, I know Cromwell has a disabled swim in the car park. It's all concrete. It's peg one, which does do fish, but I can never catch at that bloody swim. But it's not one of the best swims on the lake. But like, I know Horseshoe, the carp site is Horseshoe, the disabled point, I think they call it now, off the bit. I mean, that's one of the best areas on the lake. Always has been, even 25, 30 years ago when I used to fish, it was one of the better sort of swims because it goes right out into the middle of the lake, and if you're a big caster, that's cool. But I wonder how many other swims this chap can fish and be in a decent swim. I know lots of lakes have disabled areas.
Yeah, I would have thought more of your commercial venues are going to cater for that, whereas if you're getting off the beaten track somewhere, St Ives, somewhere wild, you're going to struggle, but there's plenty of places out there that will cater that sort of thing. Now, we've mentioned about access to that. There is one lad who comes in the shop at work. I think he's a listener as well, so big up Joel if you're listening. He's in a wheelchair, and I think he's about 16, 17, something like that. He just jumps out his chair and crawls along in the dirt to get to his swim. He does not give a damn. He just gets there. So big up the Joel.
There's a chap called Ray. I saw him recently, actually. I fished next to him on the wire many years ago, 20 years, a couple of times. I even caught the most prized fish in the lake while I was with him. I remember helping him do the photos and all that. Yeah, he caught the, what's it called now, paw print, which I happily witnessed. And he had half an arm missing. He struggled to get about, but he had a converted buggy, and it had like a trailer on the back, the sort of the old people buggies that you see everywhere in town now, like the mobility scooters. He had one like that was converted. It could put the gear on the back, which it's got to be no different to a wheelchair or electric wheelchair, except obviously it can tow your gear. So, with technology, it's got to be easier to enjoy fishing now, as a not so able-bodied person than probably it's ever been. And with carp fishing being so popular, lots and lots of lakes now have you know, flat swims and in, you know, and tracks round to the swim for a flat push of your wheelbarrow or whatever. And I bet you'd be surprised how many lakes are accessible now for you know, somebody who's game to get stuck in.
Yeah.
With a wheelchair, because you know, years ago there was no lakes had ready-made swims, did they? You know, they've all got stairs or paths down to the swims now, and a nice dugout flat swim. You know, you picture what they've done on Royston Lakes, the Nash Lakes. Picture what they've done there. You know, that was like cliffs all round. It was very hard access originally, and there's, you know, a really nice flat large swim in well, every single one now.
Obviously, oh, yeah, there has been some dirt shifted in that one.
Yeah, even Cromwell. I mean, if you had a buggy, yeah, some sort of mobility scooter, there's nowhere on that lake you couldn't fish, I don't think.
Yeah, I think we've got to tip our hats to you know, a lot of people. Like I just mentioned, young Joel. If you also get to a swim, he gets there. You know, it's there's a lot of people out there. They're very when you're put in a position like that where you've got to come up with something. They're very what's the word?
What?
Ingenious, not
yeah, sometimes just determination,
intuitive or something like that. Anyway, but yeah, there's
yeah, for
there's
sure
a lot of good people out there. No, I just thought I'd put that in because it's a bit of a feel good, you know. And if people can cast from, you know, 200 odd yards sat down, what's our excuse for not being able to do it?
Exactly. It's, you know, he's, I mean, one thing I will say, people have been in a wheelchair for a long time, their upper body strength's amazing, because you know, they obviously are negotiating a wheelchair with their arms most of the time. You know, some of the, when you look at the, you know, the Olympics and stuff, the Paralympics, you know, some of the guys in that, it's amazing. There's no way I'd be able to be that fit in a lifetime of training. So I can see why it makes sense why somebody's you know, has learned the technique of casting from sat down and can bloody wallop it. So like you say, you probably just need some concrete weights to hold you still, don't you, when you're going for it?
Yeah, you've got to have some way of anchoring yourself down there.
yeah but no, it's fantastic, and I hope to see you on a lake, Darren, yeah, Greenfield, at some point in the future. Anything else, Mark, we've spotted?
I can't think of off the top of my head, but yesterday you mentioned you wanted to talk more about your spots.
Yeah. People seem to enjoy our little spotty chat last time, where I was, you know, I was talking about spots on the Church and Copse that I've been fishing all winter. And obviously, weather's been crap this winter. There's a few lakes I've been doing fish. I did notice there was 10-40s in last week's Carp Talk. Which was unreal. But it seems that big fish have been getting caught, but not loads. You know, nowhere I know is fish well. Like, I can't think of anywhere except for the ones that, you know, saw in that Carp Talk list. Seems like a few of the more commercial waters have thrown up. Maybe not thrown up loads of fish, but when they have, it's been one of the big ones. You know, Home Fen did a big one. There's a few. Obviously, check out Carp Talk for the latest info. But I've been fishing Essex, obviously Copse and Church, and they've fished horrendous. There's been very little out. I think it's about 8 weeks ago since I last had three fish, but there's been nothing since. I think somebody's fished it over Christmas and New Year as well. I don't think they've caught. But what's interesting is one of the spots, a spot that's done probably 50% of all the bites that Roger and I have had since whenever we started fishing it, November. It started smelling. And I've spoke to Roger about it, spoke to Kevin, and all we can think of is bait. There must be bait on the spot. Now, at first, it's a pretty decent-sized spot, and I'd left the rod out for 2 days. It's only close in like an underarm, so once it's placed properly, you know, I'm happy leaving it there 2-3 days if needed. And I'd left it a couple of days, but the spot's so big that I don't mark it up or anything. I just underarm. If I get the bump down that I'm looking for, like, I clip it up, you know, clip my rig on and away I go. So I'd done that, reeled it in 2 days later. The lead stunk, the lead clip stunk, the bait stunk. Just that horrible smell. You know, like you get in silt sometimes. Just a nasty smell. But it's rock hard clay, this spot. And I was like, well, maybe I found like a nasty bit of the spot. You know, I just thought, because I hadn't plumbed it up properly, I'd just like underarm felt the bump that I thought I was looking for. I thought, oh, maybe it's just the spot. So obviously I changed the rig, had a few leads about, found the best bit of the spot that was definitely 100% rock hard, you know, rock hard clay. Put it on there, got picked up by a duck about 11 o'clock at night, so it'd only been back out like 5 hours and everything stunk again. Now this is a rock hard clean spot. The only logical solution is bait, but there's nobody else been fishing these lakes up to this point. Like, nobody. It's only me and Roger. We know it's not like a day ticket lake where you might be going in over somebody else's bait, you know, every 2 days. Somebody else new comes, puts some more bait out. There's only us been fishing it. And we know how much bait we've put on that spot. And it's literally handfuls because, you know, the fish haven't been feeding. You know, and since that last time that I had three bites off it, where you presumed that I had two bites off that spot and one bite off another spot, but you presume that that's any bait on that spot is gone. Kevin said nobody had baited it following it. So why would the spot just start smelling?
I have a theory.
Yes, go on.
Well, you know, our carp, they have feeding areas they'll come in and feed.
Yeah.
They also have areas where they will like to just bask in the sun and chill out.
Yeah.
So it stands to reason they will also have areas where they go and like to take a dump, and you are fishing in the carp's toilet.
Yeah. Well, it was a feeding spot, but obviously they toilet while they're feeding.
Yeah. Logical explanation would be that there is, you know, the smell you get, something is down there rotting. Has any weed or anything sunk down there? Any floating vegetation sunk?
No, it's the biggest spot in the lake. It's clear as anything. It's bright yellow when you go over it in the boat, and it's rock hard. Considering it's clay, it feels like gravel. You can get taps on it, which is just a rough clay where they can't feed on it because there's no gravel in the lake. There might be the odd stone that the fish have borne down, you know, they've bored into it sort of thing. But as we talked about on the last chat, if you haven't listened to the last chat about spots, we were talking about carp holes, you know, where the fish feed and they crater out a foot or two deeper. You know, this is one of those areas, and it's done. It, you know, last January and February, I had a couple of big ones, had, you know, four or five fish off that spot. It's a known feeding area. But we haven't put loads of bait on it, and the whole spot was smelling. I mean, it's a decent sized spot. You know, it's at least 8 foot by 8 foot, I would say. You
know, was anything else on the lake smelling, or just that spot?
Just that spot. And we've been fishing, this is my point, is we've been fishing all, you know, especially on the cops where I'm talking about, there isn't loads of spots. There's maybe three spots up each side. Well, three spots that we're fishing regular every week. And, you know, depending if me or Roger's on whichever side, we're both fishing the same spots. And none of us are baiting heavy. You know, literally handfuls, because the fish haven't been feeding. And it stinks. But it's a weird smell. It's a smell I've smelt lots before. And I wonder how many other times I've smelt that and just thought it's a stinky spot and not thought it's angler's bait down there. But it has to be bait. There's no other thing it can be. Yeah. It's very interesting.
I don't know, it's caught. I know, this is from when I used to use it, you know, through the summer. You know, if the dash bait, it wasn't eaten within, you know, 3 or 4 days, it generally floated up.
Yeah.
Caused that problem. That was intentional. But obviously in the winter, is it not going to do that?
No. I mean, we haven't used loads of boilies on the spots either. You know, Roger uses, he's got this like, we've had maggots on the spot. We've definitely used maggots in the last few sessions. I mean, they can, you know, they can smell if they're not eaten, but not gallons and gallons, you know, by any stretch. You know, it might take a gallon between us and fish for 3 or 4 days and, you know, half a dozen spots between us. Like, not like, you're going out and putting, you know, 2 gallons of maggots on the spot like they used to do on Christchurch and stuff. It's not like that. So, I don't know, but it confused me because it didn't smell 1 week and it did the week after.
Is there anything else in there that to clean up maggots, or would they just be left to rot? Because even like, you know, just a generous handful of maggots is a hell of a lot down there when you look at them.
There's nothing in there, no. There's no other fish than carp in there. There's not even any small ones in that one. There's a few small ones that are bred on the church, but there isn't in the cops now. They've all been took out.
So there's a good chance that there is, you know, if the carp have not eaten their maggots, then, you know, the maggots have rotted. And, well, I know from work, you know, maggots stink.
Yeah, but the thing is, when we have baited, we haven't covered the entire spot. It's a pretty big spot, and wherever I landed on the spot, it smelt.
Well, maggots crawl, and obviously they're that light. It only takes one flap of the pectoral fin of a carp, and it spreads them around a lot more than they were, so...
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there has some particle has gone down there, certainly. Maybe between me and Roger fishing the same spots, you know, between us over half of the 6 weeks, probably six sessions we did. Maybe it's just a combination, it's built up. I don't know. I really don't know. It baffled me. Definitely baffled. I mean, it has to be bait. Do you remember on Elstow 1? Obviously, they used to fish. There was a lot more fish in there, and they moved around in groups. But a lot of people used to put beds of hemp and pellet out. And when fish hadn't visited a spot for a while, that was the same. You used to pull in some of the weed off the spots, and it'd have mouldy hemp and pellet on it. You could actually pull it in, and that stunk. But the fish would have it when they decided they were going to go and eat that spot. It didn't matter that there was a load of rotting bait down there. They'd just clean the whole lot and clean the spot off. I've seen that happen on a couple of lakes, so I don't think it matters to the fish. Like, when they do want to come and eat it, they'll just eat it anyway. I mean,
yeah. Do you know, this is reminds me of something I was talking to Ed Betteridge about a while back. He was on one of these corder things. You know, where they do all this corder, is it, I don't know, corder camp or something, with the youngsters anyway.
Yeah.
They were down on, is it Manor Lakes or Manor Farm down Bedfordshire? You know, one of the lakes there. And, you know, Ed's got a couple of these lads, and, you know, I'm sure Ed will correct me, like, but if I remember rightly, the story goes he wasn't catching. He spoke to someone else who was there, and he said, just cast in the black shit. You know, the stinkier, the better. And that's where they caught all the fish from, in the horrible black stench.
That's interesting.
Yeah, because generally our instinct is to avoid it like the plague.
Very interesting. I know the guys on Pit 1 were not bothered in any way whatsoever.
How do you know? They don't speak to us.
That's another story. I'll tell you what I did do. I wrote a few thousand words in my book over Christmas period.
Ooh. You started?
Yeah, I've done probably the trickiest bit, which is getting it going. The introduction and stuff, setting the scene, and literally stories now, you know, like chapter by chapter, as it is. But I broke the back of it. I'm a procrastinator, so it was a big deal to get it up and running. But I have.
Any idea for a title?
Probably something to do with the knowledge, because that's kind of what my DVD series is called, and the coaching that I've set up. In fact, you can book coaching with me now. In fact, a chap called Daniel Hume has messaged me right now with a couple of dates in February. He wants to do a tuition. But yeah, you can go on our website, www.thecarpcast.com, and you can book some time with me. It's obviously cheaper if there's two of you. But it's quite fairly priced compared to some of the others. If you want to come and pick my brains and do some fishing, then you can do. There's an itinerary on there on the website, tells you what to expect from me. You're going to get back into the coaching, Mark? I know you've got your level 2 coach and qualification.
Probably not, to be honest, but that's a time thing more than anything else.
Yeah.
You know, call me selfish, but I get 2 days off a week and I like to do my own fishing.
Yeah, well, I'm offering my coaching at Clearwater Fisheries. I mean, I will go somewhere else, but the actual you know, if you really want to. But the actual deal that I've that I'm offering, it includes your permits and stuff at Clearwater. It includes bait, and Clearwater Fisheries do sponsor the carp cast. We're going to be doing a social down there this year. I think we're going to get all the dates together. We're going to try and do half a dozen socials at least this year, between sort of March, April maybe, and October. We're going to make them a bit cheaper this year. We're going to, you know, we've listened to some people saying that they, you know, they don't really want to to learn anything on the social. They just want to come and fish and agree with a few other Carpcast listeners and with us. So we will make it cheaper. Probably going to be charging about $150, something like that, I would have thought, for the weekend. Food will be extra if we get Richard down with the fired up barbecues. But one of them will certainly be on Clearwater Fisheries. And if you haven't checked out Clearwater Fisheries yet, a friend of ours, Alex, has purchased the fishery. It's fantastic. It's on Kellett Lane, which is in Carnforth in Lancashire. Oh, my missus just put some nice food down for me. Might hear me jumping in a minute, Mark.
Watch that plate.
Thank you. Missing my tea to record this. But yeah, Clearwater Fisheries in Carnforth. It's got fish to over £40 now. Alex has spent tens of thousands on fish for the winter. There's a complex of lakes down there. There's big pike, carp, runs water. As I said, the main carp lake is going to be syndicate eventually, but it's certainly day ticket now. You can buy a syndicate ticket on there. I forget the price of it now, but if you go to the Clearwater Fisheries and Cafe Facebook page, you will be able to have a look on there for the prices. I think it runs like November to November. If you're going to plan to be down there quite regularly, it might be cheaper to do it that way. But it is day ticket at the minute. There's various lakes on there. If you want to take the kids fishing, there's float waters, stuff full of smaller fish, your hides and skimmers and small carp and stuff. There's absolutely everything down there, including a fantastic cafe, which has got a top chef in there. And the food is absolutely beautiful. And that's where I'm doing the coaching as well this year. The coaching price does include tickets to fish the lake for a couple of days. It will include your bait. So check out Clearwater Fisheries in Carnforth, and check out the Carpcast website if you are interested. So we've got a whole list of decent guests lined up for the new year. We're going to be getting a load of people that haven't been on before. I've got a list as long as my arm down here of people that I need to lock down. You know, people from Miles Gibson to Alan Taylor. Loads of them. I'm not going to spoil it for you, actually. I'm looking at the list now. But we will be getting all those recorded very soon. But in the meantime, we spoke to one of the times I was down at Nash's Lake. We decided to go technical and have a rig chat with Roger Bacon and Kevin Nash, because I know we're on Roger Bacon's episode. Some people were saying it's one of the best episodes we had because of all the technical knowledge from Roger's mind in there. So we decided to sit down and really go deep on rigs. And Nash has always been a thinking angler regarding rigs and his end tackle, and so has Roger. So we all sat down together, and this is what came out. Here again with Kevin and Roger. I know you had some thoughts, Kevin, when Roger was on the show a little while back. Roger blew a few people's minds with his rig talk. He was friends with Frank from back in the 80s, and technical stuff was always sort of key. We've always had the technical chats, haven't we, Roger, about the how rigs work, the actual physical the things we're trying to achieve with the blowbacks, with the anti-eject, with tightening rigs up. And I know you had some thoughts, Kevin, somebody who's thought about rigs. I believe we've just done a rig chapter in your own book as well. So I think let's get geeky, let's get technical. I mean, what would you say
Roger, first, is what's the main criteria you're looking for in the rig? You're trying to hook a fish on the suck and blow. You're trying to what are the main key important things you're trying to do?
I think obviously the first thing I think about is where am I fishing? You know, what sort of lake am I fishing? Am I fishing a pressured lake? Am I fishing, a hungry lake where it's quite easy to catch the fish and hook the fish? Once I've determined the style of fish that I'm fishing for, I mean, let's take, for instance, where I'm fishing now, on the Copse Lake here, it's really small, pressured fish. Them fish are not going to, as a first sort of reaction to picking a hook bait up, they're not going to bolt straight away. They're not going to just waff it down. They're going to suck and blow. Maybe if they do get pricked, they're not going to move off the spot. They're going to try to shake. You know, all the things that you've heard about over the years about fish,
pressured
fish, shaking the head, try to get rid of it. You know, so if I was fishing that sort of lake, I would really try and hook a fish. Well, not hook it, but prick it. I'm always trying to prick, because it's the prick that comes before the hooking. It's, maybe with the modern hooks that we've got, with hand sharpening hooks, maybe you might, on the ejection, on the blowout, it might sink past the barb because the points are so far. So you might hook on the blowout, but I'm really trying to prick on the blowout, and then obviously from
when they bolt,
and then from that point on, they can't get rid of it, and they bolt, and then you hook. So I do tend to, obviously I fish quite hard waters, as a general rule. So I'm always on the anti-ejection, on the blowout, and trying to prick on the blowout.
And then using the weight of the lead, obviously, and the resistance to set the hook.
Yeah, as Frank said, Frank's quite a heavy lead user, and I always have, traditionally, I've always used heavier leads than most people see on the lake. And I mean, you had evidence of that, didn't you, when Frank was fishing with you on Christchurch?
So. Yeah. Yeah. Any initial comments on that, Kev?
I think to understand what you're doing, you've got to understand what the carp are doing. And interesting listening to Roger, key point I was taking is trying to prick them on the blowout. Carp picks up bait, hook, if it's super sharp, may nick in their mouth before they level the hook link up to the lead and the resistance of the lead, or at that point it will prick them. It's just a question of how deep it goes in. But I think what you're saying, Roger, is that you are hoping your rig and your sharp hook, you are hooking them before the lead comes into play, right?
Yeah.
And I think you could well be doing that, because I've seen your rig, which is an extended D. Mm-hmm. Yeah? The D ending below the I.
That's right, yeah.
Right. So I would suggest that in its own right is a rig edge on the majority of pressured waters, because it would catch the carp out, because they're not used to seeing it. You know, the skill and the intricacy of your rig is something that your average angler wouldn't go to trouble of. So first point I'm trying to make is that's going to be a damn good rig on any water in the country, because the majority of carp have never seen it. Why I think it's an exceptional rig other than that is because the length of movement the bait has got when it's blowing out. Longer amount of movement, so when the fish blows against that bait, there's more force as that hook bait goes down the D to drive that hook in just a little bit more.
So what you're saying, it's got more distance to travel.
More
so
distance
because it's
to
got
travel.
More distance to travel, it creates more force, and when it eventually stops, it's a greater weight.
Exactly. So you force that hook in just a little bit further than your average.
Yeah.
Well, let's say, for example, a tube blowout rig. Yeah, because it can only go back to the tube. But that, that works on what you said, the more lesser waters. But where your rig is interesting and I do it exactly the same way but go a step further is with my original blowout ring rig, which has been much misunderstood. In fact, it caused some quite harsh correspondence with me and Tim Paisley once because he mistranslated it. My original ring blowout rig was designed with a ring big enough to go over the eye of the hook.
Mm-hmm.
So it's acting the same way as your D, that it's travelling a great distance to thump the hook in. But the difference being, and where I would suggest that carp who regularly come up against your D-rig would suss it before mine, is that they can suck it back up. And everyone talks about blow, they don't talk so much about suck. You know, and that's why I designed it like that. So when it's blowing back up the hook link, it in effect becomes ineffective because they can't blow it back up the hook to a point where they can easily then, suck it back up the hook to a point where they can easily just suck it and pull the point out.
Reverse everything.
Yeah. But other than that, well, I say it's not other than that, you know, so I'm observing why I think your rig's so good, and I'm just saying that one step only that I know past that is to stop and managing to bring the bait back up to put it in a good position so they can suck it out.
Well, that's something I've never, well, to be honest, it's something I've never thought of, you know, going beyond the blow of the ejection. It's something I've never thought of, and now you're saying after that you can possibly, the fish will, I mean, it's natural for the fish to suck and blow. If it's in any sort of trouble, it will just suck and blow. So yeah, once it's blown, felt the prick, the possibility of it being re-sucked back up.
Exactly. Well, you know, the progress I went through, first of all I found the ring blowout, then I found the tube which I used as a telltale, and then constant pressure with that on waters, I noticed it lost its effectiveness. Going back to the ring restores the effectiveness. Yeah, it's really interesting, as Jamie said, I've just been writing the rig chapters in my book, and when you're putting stuff in paper, you're really putting all, you know, all the events down. And the original hair rig was blown, was tied off the middle of the bend, right? And that lost its effectiveness. We found by tying it opposite the point on the shank got us the takes going again, and that lasted for a few years. Well, it's only when I was writing the book I realised that even then they must have been doing this by sucking, because if you blow against that original hair, the perfect place to really nail the hook in is if it's tied middle the bend, isn't it? Because it's then dead centre and it'll pull that hook in. It's also the perfect place if you want to pull it out, isn't it? Because they then suck and it's attached dead centre of the bend, so it's easy for them to pull it out. By moving the attachment point to the back of the shank, when they then try and suck, the hook tips up. So it just about manages to keep the point, the hook just about manages to stay in because they can't do a direct suck on it. Even right back then, as I wrote it, well, that's how they did it on the original hair. They learnt to suck.
Yeah. That's interesting, actually, because I hadn't thought about that before. When obviously they're sucking and blowing, when even if they realise something's wrong, they still suck and blow, don't they? It's still, you know, they're breathing, aren't they? And I've seen them, you know, seen on the videos when they suck up a heap of gravel and they filter in their mouth what's food and what isn't. It's you know, it's two or three sucks and blows, isn't it? It's not one. Whereas we've been thinking about the rigs as that one blowout.
We've just been thinking about the sucking and the blowout and the one blowout. That's the end of the story.
No, I say that's the point. You know, they've learned to suck to rid, as I realised with the blow, with a ring blowback. But say it goes back. You know, so they clearly were doing that with the original hair. Clearly, that's how they've done us on it.
So
you've got to think more suck than you have blow, really.
There's an argument to say, like, just doing something slightly different. Because, I mean, we've had this conversation before. How smart are they? Are they literally just creatures of habit that learn one particular way? If everybody's fishing a hair off the shank, off the bend, then it doesn't take long for them to realise if I suck a bit harder, it actually pings it out. So we start fishing a longer hook link or a longer hair or just something that actually is different to how they've just learned to deal with whatever we're doing.
I mean, this only applies to fish lakes where fish are getting caught, you know, constantly. So, you know, a well-stocked lake that's got a big group of anglers fishing it, you know, maybe 20 people at the weekend, 20 pegs or something swims. These fish are getting caught repeatedly throughout the course of a year. You're fishing for a fish that gets caught once a year. I mean, how much is it learning? I mean, how many times is it picking it up anyway and just getting away with it and you don't know, I suppose?
That's the one, isn't it?
It could be like tricking itself every month.
Yeah, but, you know, that fish might only be getting caught once a year, but, you know, it's going around the lake, it's visiting baited areas on a regular basis. It might even be feeding on the areas. And
so other anglers are showing us what we should be doing, which is basically, if you walk around the lake and everybody's using a 7-inch hook link with a 1 centimetre hair, all you've got to do is doesn't matter which way you go, but do something that is going to have the opposite effect to what the majority are doing.
That's why I don't like to say, you know, this is the best rig, because I don't think there's any such thing as the best rig. I think, you know, it's just change
for that circumstance.
You know, it's the best rig. If it's something different, it's catching them out, and it might be something completely simple. It might not be a complicated anti ejection blowback rig. It might just be because everyone's fishing that at the time. Just something. I mean, I spoke to you in the last couple of days, the last sort of week about the rig Mark's been using, which, you know, is completely the opposite to my rig, and it's been catching fish. Been catching fish to the point where it's really made me look at it, and I'm thinking, you know, I might even go and cast it out tonight when I go back to the cops.
But what rig's that? Describe that one, or is it secret?
I'd rather not at the minute, to be honest.
But it's different.
So. Yeah, it's completely different.
But taking your point, Roger, you know, well, you did down the cops last time. Yeah. You don't need to change your rig yet.
Yeah.
Because those fish, I doubt if those fish, I know what I've used on there, and I've never taken a long D route track. I know the majority, well, when it was a syndicate lake, I knew what all the labs used, and with respect to those much more basic anglers, those fish down there have not seen your rig.
Yeah.
You know, so you've got a fair bit of mileage until they're conditioned. And you know, I think I've said I can't. Yeah. Cast before, I get a bit irritated when people suggest carp are stupid. They're not. Yeah, you know,
they're just conditioned.
Yeah, you know, they're conditioned, and once they come up against something new, just like humans would, we trip up. But they bloody learned quick. To answer the question you said, those cops carp, you might trip them up twice on the same method.
Yeah,
you won't trip them up a third time. My experience, a lot of them, you won't even trip up a second time. Excuse me, a second time. You know, they're that cute and wise old fish there. You know, so it is just about moving on to something they've never seen before, which could be very simple or complex. You know, classic trigger link.
Yeah.
You know, I think I've got this down to there's two ways they get rid of a hook. Basically, either sucking it out, or they're lifting the lead, swinging the lead quickly, and that
ripping it out. Yeah.
So when you take that point, so the carp hasn't got off the hook, it then lifts its lead off the bottom, snatches its head, you can see where triggering comes in, because suddenly it's catapulting that hook in by that dirty great lump of lead. So that's obvious why that works.
But their natural reaction when they're pricked is to shake the head and bolt, isn't it? Which even without, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I was used to use heavy lead. You know, I used to judge the size of the lead by the distance that I needed to cast, as opposed to the, you know, the hooking effectiveness of it.
John, and then, can I just come in there?
Yeah.
I actually, twice in the last 2 weeks, I've had guys on about this, and I made the comment that I reckon the majority of anglers, might be 90%, the size of weight they're using is what they feel is adequate for the cast.
Yeah.
Rather than thinking, forget
the effectiveness of the rig.
I used to, you know, for probably 20 years now, I've used 4 ounce plus leads 1 metre out.
Yeah.
Yeah. The lead, is, from my point of view, is key point of it is to pull that hook in.
Well, I used to use 4 ounces plus for everything, for all my fishing. And then I remember fishing, probably my first serious syndicate water was where there were other people watching what you're doing, was Yateley Car Park. And everyone was how stealthy you could be. You know, it gave me a lesson in being quiet and paying attention. And, you know, if you have two casts, the fish are gone. So there was a bit of this stereotype of make as little disturbance as possible. So there's me with my 4 ounce leads casting 40 yards out, making a big badoosh when I hit the water. And I was one of them, used to call me the fly fisherman, I was one of them that liked to make sure the spot was perfect before. So I might have 50 casts with a marker float, making sure I was on the best possible spot I could be in, within the spot, if you know what I mean. And then I'd be casting me heavy lead on it, and I kind of got pressured or conditioned into using the lightest possible lead I could get away with, and not thinking about the rig. It was just these guys are better anglers than me, I'm young and naive, and you know, I feel like I have to be doing things how they're doing rather than what had worked for me for all the years. And it was a case of, you know, these fish are pressured these days, have more than one cast and you spooked them. So it was, I actually changed my fishing a little bit. And it's only recently I've started using heavier leads again and thinking about it. And I've also learned that it doesn't matter how many casts you have, the fish are there because they want to be there. I'm not saying it doesn't happen on pressured lakes where you'll cast in amongst a group of fish, they'll spook, you know, they're super spooky and they vanish at the other end of the lake, never to be seen again. I'm sure that happens, and more so on certain lakes. But in my experience, if you found an area they want to be because of a snag, a weed, a overhanging tree, a margin, whatever, then even when you spook them or land a lead near them, they only move 10 feet away, 10 yards away, and they come back because there's a reason why they were there in the first place. So big leads, doesn't really matter, get the spot right, make sure you're completely happy, and have a lead that's going to effectively, you know, mechanically do the job that you need it to do, I guess. And I don't know, I think I went the other way for a bit, and not for any reason, that not through experience, it was through probably being pressured to, you know.
Well, I had exactly the same sort of thing happen to me over the years. I mean, we used to fish in the mid 80s, we used to go down Darren from fish Darren for Big Lake. And at the time, I would probably say we used to think more about rigs and
than disturbing fish.
Yeah, at the time. And as you say, over the years, maybe it's through conditioning or whatever, that's sort of gone. But even then, we used to use... we had a lead mould, me and Saul. This lead mould had two sizes of leads. One was, they were quite... If you can imagine a lead about the length of your finger, but at one end it's about as thick as your finger, but at the other end it was as wide, sort of this sort of wide, so it really tapered to a real heavy end. And we didn't even know how much these leads ones we'd made and weighed, but we used to fish them with a piece. The lead itself was about 3.5-4 inches long. We used to fish a stiff piece of tubing out the back of the lead.
Yeah.
So obviously once with a really short hook length, the hook length itself was no longer than the lead and the tubing combined. So you used to use hook lengths about 6 inches long. Half the hook length would be popped up, half would be on the floor. And obviously once the fish had pricked itself, it would then pick the weight of the lead up, and then the lead would actually pivot on the stiff tubing that came out the back.
Yeah.
So you'd have a lead, do you know what I mean? It'd still be in contact with the floor, but it would pivot like this.
Yeah.
And then one day we thought, it was only me that used to use the bigger ones. So one day I thought, I'm going to weigh this lead, because I've never weighed it. Anyway, we weighed it and it was 5.25 ounce. At the time, which was, you know, you're talking like mid 80s, there was no one was using that, you know, that sort of weight. And we used to use, as I say, we used to use it, the hook length would be 3 or 4 inches long, half the hook length would be popped up with a pop up, but we used to cast it out with a piece of polystyrene on it, and it couldn't tangle because it was, you know, the lead was this long and the tubing was that long on the back.
Yeah, so the tubing's, the lead's half the length of the whole thing.
And the hook length was always shorter, so we'd literally cast it out, not worry about a tangle at all, because it fly out, it'd hit the bottom, the whole thing would cock up, and then we'd pull it back onto a gravel spot, or we might even cast it over an island, use the wind to create a bow, so it'd land out of sight on the back. You could actually literally pull it back
up to the island,
up the shallow shelf, the gravel shelf on the back of the island, and with binoculars, after about 3 or 4 minutes, you'd see the square piece of polystyrene pop up on the surface, and we would sort of say, oh, the rig's set.
Yeah,
you know, and the amount of fish we caught on that.
So you're using overweights, you're using overweight or normal weight to get the pop-up back down?
Yeah, not slow sinking, quite overweight. So once it fell, we used to try and achieve a little bit of a curl so it would drop straight on its spot. And
using braid for the hook length so it would curl
supple
up.
Hook length, yeah. Supple hook length so it would drop straight on its spot, and then literally the fish would come along, suck it in, it would literally only have one or two inch movement, and then it would pick the whole weight of this lead, which is pivoting on the stiff.
So it's a stiff tubing, same distance outside each end of the lead. So it was running through the centre of the lead.
It only came out the back. Oh, when it came out the back, just like you'd fish in line lead now, you've got the swivel straight into the front. You know, and as I say, we used that for quite a few years and caught loads of fish, and there was nobody at the time using anything like that. It was in the bent hook days, you know, where everyone was using pop-ups tied directly straight onto the back of the hook. There was no movement in the pop-up, it was tied literally onto the back of the hook over the piece of tubing. And I don't know why we stopped using them, because it was really effective.
It's fun, isn't it, how we stop effective things, but
for no reason, because there's a new craze or a new
fashion. I mean, I've since said to Saul, you know, where is that lead mould? I want to make them leads again.
I was thinking as you were talking, Roger, that me and Gary always use round leads. Again, you know, it's not only about the weight, is it? It's the shape of it to maximise the mass. You know, you don't want casting leads, for example.
Yeah.
You know,
they
lift one end of it, the other end will be on the
ground. I mean, you can have a 6 ounce lead that doesn't
I use round
impact all the weight straight away. Obviously, it's the position of the lead.
The best inverted commas leads I ever had, and I had four of them. Gary nicked one, and I eventually lost the upper three. And they're a massive edge, but tungsten ones.
And
they did two things. They are much heavier, but also you could cast them onto jumping fish, because they make a different noise as they go in the water. That's amazing.
Just that different thing again,
I've said a couple of times in the last few years, I need to look at sourcing someone who can machine us up tungsten leads again. Leads, but irregardless of the price, it's a real fishing edge because of the mass of them and the sound they make.
I just showed Roger your leads on the website before. I mean, you didn't know all the different ones you do. Do you do like a flat, square one, really flat one, don't you? Which again is different. I mean, how many
always
people
go on
to use
shorter?
Them?
I want really short leads with a maximum mass. Obviously, the round ones are picked to cast, but I always go for a real dumpy pair.
I used to use those round leads, completely circular, heavy leads on Fendrayton when I was boat fishing there.
Back in the late 80s, you know, the lads that are listening to this that fished any of the Cheshire Mares at the time, Frank, Bernard, Tomlinson twins, we all used to use ball leads. You know,
that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
ball ones.
We all used to use a ball lead, just
pick to caster.
Yeah, audible to cast, but as you say, the mass of the lead once the fish pit the upland foot, the mass was
it's
there.
The same from any angle, isn't it?
And
what was your thinking behind the pivoting lead? So there's some short hauling, but there's still some play before they get the full weight of the lead.
We just used the foot. Obviously, the a lot of the weight of the lead, the way it was designed, was at the front. And I don't know, we just obviously with the stiff tubing at the back, we just wanted to achieve that once the fish had picked it up, it was kind of hanging underneath its. But as I say, the actual weight of the lead itself was probably more important than anything else. It was, you know. Eventually, once it was over 5 ounce
in a day, everyone was using 1.5, 2 ounce.
Yeah. And then I went through. Obviously, everyone went through the phase where using the 3 and 4 ounce leads. But then, as I say, I've always been more of the shorter the distance, the heavier lead sort of it for me. Do you know what I mean?
I just remember something else that was brought up in your Roger rig talk, which I've got a different view on, and that was. You were talking about eliminating any movement, i.e. the hook link and the hook coming and meeting into play with the lead.
Yeah.
Do you remember?
Yeah,
it's like a lead clip where
lead.
You've got the,
yeah.
The swivel. Sounds arrogant to say I disagree, but I look at it a different way. I went through all that, by the way. When I did my slideshow in the mid-90s, I used to show a slide where I used to cut the swivel off, and then the leads we had then, we had the brass loop formed in the lead like a keyhole shape, so that the hole at the top would eject off the lead clips. But then later on, I realised I wanted a little bit of movement so I could get indication on the bite alarm.
Right.
And that's how I fish now. I always want an element of indication, a movement, so I can get that single bleep on an R3.
Before the...
So I know a fish is rigged up.
Before it's nailed itself. Yeah, I mean, I guess...
Well, it has nailed itself. The point is, it's trying to get off the bloody thing by sitting on the spot.
Yeah.
Shaking it. So I want that. I want actually to be able to get that little bit of line movement.
What about, like, a... if we're focusing on the lead, then like a running lead setup, where so we're using, you know, whatever type of rig you're using, they've still, if they lift up, they're still going to get the weight of the lead on a running lead, but you're getting indication.
I didn't want to go there, Jamie, because it's all in my book.
Okay.
But to my mind, okay, the ultimate rig, or an ultimate setup for me at this stage in carp fishing, is a running lead that will then hit a backstop, but then if they try and shake it, the backstop will slip.
That was my carp rig
since the 90s.
In the early 80s, when I was young, 13, 14 years old, and started carp fishing, they were the rigs. We had them, do you remember those flat, they were like float stocks where you, they were plastic and you push the inner inside it.
Yeah.
We used to use them as backstops on them, because it was all running leads then. There were no lead clips and stuff in those days. So you actually had a, there was no swivel either. Your hook link was, it was all, well, we used to use them. Your main line was your hook link. So you'd tie the hook on, you'd thread the backstop on, you'd then thread your lead on, and then you'd use a lead shot to stop, you know, like 6 inches or 8 inches away from your hook. You'd use a lead shot to actually stop the lead, you know, going down to your hook. And then your hook would be on there, and you'd, you know, put your luncheon meat or whatever it was on. It was, you know, there was no swivel, there was no separate hook link. But we always had those float stops at the back, and the reason why we used those is because they would slip. I think we used float stops the other end sometimes as well.
What, to stop your lead from coming down to your hook?
Yeah, but we were, you know, we're talking using 5 pound line those days, and the leads were probably an ounce.
You know, this book deals in warm wear and all that, and that's when I was really into running rigs, which were 4 ounce lead, anti-tangled tube with a rubber stop on the anti-tangled tube, which I would have to attempt possibly adjust on the day or the hour. You know, go from screaming takes to twitches up to the indicating drop, and I always sold that just by moving the backstop. But translate that to today, as I say, if you accept that mainly they're getting off the rig by sucking the hook out or using the lead, right, to wrench the hook
out.
So imagine, you know, so if you say got 4 inches of running lead before it hits the backstop, that 4 inches is giving you the indication. They hit the backstop, that pulls it in. And I used to set the, well, I still do, I set the drop on the indicator, so the moment they hit the backstop bead, that's a point where the line clip is also, so it's a double thing, bang, the backstop's hit, the line clip also nails it in, and you rarely get a screaming take then. But just assume that some do sit on the spot, they lift that lead, swing it, and it's acting the same way to trigger link. Not the elastic, but the key point is to make sure that bead can move. If you, you know, do that with the lead, so it's got enough grip to nail the fish. But if they really try and snag it, then the bead slides down. So all you're doing is lengthening, if you like, the hook link as they're trying to swing it out.
Yeah,
yeah. That is, to my mind, where I fish now.
So there's a number of points here. There's basically has to be adjusted. There is no right and wrong way. It's got to be adjusted to every situation that that you might encounter, depending on what you think the fish are doing.
And that could vary hour to hour, Jamie.
Hour to hour, definitely lake to lake. I like the idea of having that little bit of play. I've always used really short hook links with my lead clip setup, and I've got even more play than your average lead clip setup, because I always clip my hook link on using you know, a type 2 clip, or, you know, whatever, it's just a quick change clip, so I've basically got the swivel on the lead. It means I can use a very short hook link, which you will sort of mickey out of me for my short hook links, haven't you, Roger?
Yeah.
But there is there's a hell of a lot of play in there, because you've got the distance from the swivel on the lead to the lead clip, so there's a little bit
almost
of play
like
there.
And also, really, what you're saying,
I've got a ring swivel, which has got an extra, you know, the ring bit is an extra attachment to a normal swivel, so there's a little bit of play there. Then I've got the actual loop itself that I use to hook the rig onto the thing. So I reckon it's extending, you know, physically, it's extending my hook link 2 inch, 3 inch or something from whatever the hook link I use, just because there's another 2 or 3 inches of play. But I like the idea of, like you say, of those couple of beats that you get before a screamer. I mean, back in the 80s, we were getting one toners and nothing else, because quite often we were getting the line bowstring tight. Sometimes you'd have an angle with your rod, so there's a bit of a bend in the rod. You'd fish your monkey climbers right up to the top and the line really tight in a light clip. So there was no indication it was an absolute screamer, because, and I think some of that helped with the effectiveness of hooking the fish, isn't it? The second they lift that lead up, it's springing back to a degree, isn't it? Because well, they're stretching your line. And
yeah, you're bringing the other element in here. And it's such a big one in hooking them and getting them to stay on, and that's elasticity. I mentioned hook links, but also the rod tip. Yeah, yeah. Tight lining, as we all know, with the rod tips kicked over, was awesome. You know, to if they got hooked up on it, they struggled to get off. Yeah, and yeah, I applied that in Final Count. I never actually said what I was doing. I let people work it out. But what I was doing there was, I was using a 5 ounce inline front lead that could eject off the rig because of the weed, and I was using 6 ounce back leads where I had a bit of tube attached to the lead with a ring with a slot in it, so that was slot on the line. And then if you look on Final Count, I had the rod tips
up in the air.
And I would crank the spool down until I just felt the front lead start to slip a little bit. That's why it's an ounce lighter. So I had rod tips bent right over to the 6 ounce back lead, going out to the 5 ounce leads. And the moment they nudged that lead, it catapulted back. Mm. You know, and some of the takes I was getting was mind blowing. You know, I think I showed it in there where I had to try and reenact what happened, because, you know, the rod literally blew off the bank sticks and jammed around the buzzer. But yeah, you know, but so bringing that other element into play of you know, of the rod tip, you know, so it all comes together then. You know, it was awesome.
I'm no clearer in working out what rig I should be using. I'm just more confused now. Do we?
Well, as you say, I mean, he's talking. You know, you've got where
I'm going a bit
fish are picking up
too.
Fish are picking up the, you know, the full weight of the lead straight away. You can go that sort of way, or it reminds me of not long back. I think it was Joe Morgan. He might have been on some sort of Facebook video, but he was demonstrating again. It was an inline lead sort of setup. But it was semi-fixed. So as soon as the fish picked it up, it didn't take a lot of movement from the fish at all to dislodge. But it was running on the line, the inline lead.
Yeah.
But it was really impressive. It did make me think. It was impressive how the fish picked it up, and as soon as it gave it any sort of shake, the lead kind of fell off, but stayed on the line.
Yeah.
And then it was. I mean, the demonstration he was doing, he was showing how much more sensitive he could make his indication. You know, and as soon as he did that, it was in effect, the fish was like, there was no weight directly under the fish's mouth, but his bobbing was moving a lot.
Yeah.
You know.
Was it another way to skin the cat?
I just talked about
massively heavy leads putting the hook in, but you know, the weed safe bolt beads we use call them now, lead clips, right? Use a heavy lead, set that tube so that the tail rubber, so it pulls the hook in. Then they go and swing to get rid of lead, and the lead comes off.
Yeah.
You know, so that's another way.
That's a very fine balance. You were saying to me, you know, I've told you about the 2 or 3 fish that I've lost this year, where I believe I've lost them because the lead's come off too quick.
It's simple, Jamie, I'll tell you. Just grab a hold of hook link and go bump.
Yeah? Yeah.
If it really takes some resistance to get it off, you know after a while. If it come off easy, then you ain't got it on tight enough.
Yeah.
If you do that and it's still on there, you know it's too tight.
What it was my fault. I was trying to use the weed clips for everything, and the lead, whereas you can use a normal clip, you can set it to come off as easy as a weed clip. With a weed clip, you can't set it any, so it comes off less easy. it's just coming off easy every time. And I was using laziness, really, because they were already on me. Thing is, I was using weed clips in situations where I shouldn't have been using the weed clip, so fish was able to shake the lead off too easy. You know, whereas I should have had, you know, multiple setups, so I could just think, right, I don't want it to come off that easy. but I do want it to come off in weed, so I can set it to a certain point where they can shake it off.
Yeah, well, I've had the exact same sort of thing happen to me this year. I've been fishing a syndicate where, you know, the bloke that runs this syndicate is you've got to drop your leads if he's in your peg and you land a fish and the lead has not been dropped. You know, you get yellow carded. He won't be happy. So as a consequence, everyone's using clips that the lead, you know, 100% comes off, and probably half a dozen times already this year I've been sat behind my rods, I've had a really fast drop back.
No lead.
Wound in, no leads on, no fishes on, and I spoke to the rest of the lads there and it's just the fish doing you. Yeah.
They're not doing you, the lead's just not getting a chance to do its job.
Yeah,
before
because everyone's
off.
Too paranoid
yeah,
about
which
you know,
is exactly.
If I reset it and make it so the lead's a little bit harder to come off, you know, it might not come off and the owner's there and you're in trouble.
Yeah. It's a fine balance, isn't it? Like I say, using the weed clips, I've had it, especially if you're using heavy leads. What happens with me is I never cast out without a stick on. So the resistance of the stick when it hits the water and your lead pulling it, it's already pulling it halfway off.
Pea him up, Jamie.
Yeah.
Get some pea.
That's what it needs, yeah, because the lead clip's fine when I set it in the edge, but what's happened is it's already pulled it halfway by the time the lead's hit the bottom because of the resistance.
Yeah, I know that kind of tension, but then I wrap PVA tape around.
Yeah, that's probably what I should have done is I should have just kept using the weed clips, but PVA'd it for the cast.
And obviously, the bigger the bag you put on,
the easier the lead.
You know, whether it's a big crumb bag or whether it's a big blagger bag.
It blows a bagger off if you're not careful, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know what's happening because you're loosening it because the worst way is you can't whack it out and if you don't PVA it up, your lead blows off.
I've had that hundreds of times. Yeah. I've only fished that way for the last 10 years probably, you know, with a clippable hook link and a stick threaded through just for the presentation. And you know, the amount of times you don't quite hit your clip properly on the cast, you cast a bit further, the lead just comes off, you're like, fucking hell, you know, reeling it in, have to do it again.
I did the same with running rigs actually. It was on Star Lane when I first started using, and every time I was turning up in the beginning was in the night. I was using running rigs with PVA bags, and I caught from the second session, I think it was probably the fifth or sixth, I can't remember. I arrived before dark, whacked it out, and I watched my PVA bag sit on the surface. And so I realised, you know, my lead had just been sliding down a line, and all these sessions I've been using like a 6-7 foot hook link.
Yeah.
Still catching, but it's obvious when you don't think, when you do think about it, if you're fishing running leads with PVA bags or anything, you need to PVA that lead up, otherwise it's going to end up miles down your...
What's your first choice rig on a clean bottom then, if you know that there's no weed issues? Are you using an inline lead, are you using a running lead, are you using a...
My first choice in any situation where I can achieve it will always be a running rig.
Yeah.
Because, again, few people are using them. But they also get over so many of these problems we've been talking about of carp using the lead to get rid of the rig. But incredibly, they're amazing running rigs. Yeah.
Again, if we're just trying to be different and put something out the carp's not used to, I mean, 90% of anglers are, you've got your anglers that chod fish, and then you've generally got your anglers that lead clip fish. And there's not been a lot in between as a
condition to a certain amount of movement, and then they find a lead.
Yeah, so you know, most fish when they've been caught over the last God knows how many years, been caught one of those two ways.
Ask any angler. Where angler these days? Have you ever used a running rig?
Most of them.
When was the last time you used one?
Everybody did in the early 80s, because when you transitioned from that, you know, like bream fishing, tench fishing, or whatever, just running lead. So I mean, that's how you fish. You fish a light running lead with a stop, you know.
That's a trick, Jamie. You'll get a ball it takes if you fish a light lead.
Yeah.
Luckily, I learned that from piking.
You need a heavy running lead.
You need a minimum of 4 ounces. Yeah, I think what we learned from piking is because we just get drop takes. I think maybe not if they're picking up and running direct away from the lead, but any other angle sideways, they move the lead. And they feel that lead movement, and the same absolutely happens with carp. And Smiley Muse talking earlier about you change something. I had 2 years of incredible success with 4 ounces of running leads, and then I read a Dave Lane article, I think it was Haldon, where he wrote about catching on light running lead rigs,
And, you know, I got influenced and I started getting twitches, indicators sand to the top and nothing. You know, this happened over 3-4 sessions and God knows how many fish it cost me, because it should have been a red letter time. But then I went back to 4-ounce leads and the take started coming again. Yeah, you know, so I think they are moving that lead as they're running away and they feel it. So it's very important, whether, like I say, that's a reference I made when I said I'll use a 4-ounce lead only a metre out. Yeah, always using a minimum of 4-ounce lead on me running rigs.
So what you're saying, Kev, is you want the lead not to move. You want the lead to stay put.
Imagine that lead's on the bottom and the carp goes at an angle which can, you know, it swivels round. The lead swivels round for the line to flow through it. Yeah, I think they feel that movement, and I think the reason Dave Lane had so much success on running light running leads at Horton because it was full of weed, so that light lead was jamming up in the weed.
I remember going over to Cavagnac in the early days and they had a lot of pads there, and David, who was running it there, was telling me to use running leads because the fish would kite behind the pads, mm-hmm. and you would quite often not know, you'd have a bite and not really know about it, and running legs was the way to get around that, so you still get the indication. But I mean, what you're saying about getting indication light early, we're still kind of relying on the lead and the movement to actually set the hook. I mean, are you hitting twitches and stuff, you know, are you looking for that first couple of beeps to be able to strike? I mean, or are you just looking at it because you want something to do before it screams off, which it's probably going to do eventually?
What I'm saying is, I pricked the carp, it then nows itself even more on the lead, right? But in that process, there's been a bleep or two on the R. There's RS1s from me and, you know, first doing this with Alan, now the R3s. And then it's sitting on the spot and it would start shaking its head to try and get rid of the lead. But because I've had that bleep, I will nail it. And, well, I think it was 3-4 winters ago, me and Ann did a whole winter. I think we had 14 bites between January and February. 9 or 11 were on single bleeps. Mm. Yeah, none of them were screamers. I remember Alan, it was one morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, freezing night, he shot out of his bag on one bleep. You know, I remember him saying, I shit myself when a siren bleeps, you know, just that one bleep, he was out of the bag and he was attached to the car. Funny enough, he did a talk at the weekend at Sandon and he'd gone to bite indication. He made me laugh this morning. He was saying that he asked everyone to put up their hands who haven't experienced their bite alarms bleeping all day long. And he said nearly the whole room put up their hands. So they're just not getting it. You know, they're using alarms or they haven't got their indication right. They're prepared to let them just sit there and bleep for whatever time and they just ignore it. You know, any single bleep, I'm on it. I'll hit it and hopefully there'll be a fish on the end. If there's not a fish on the end, maybe bad luck, I'll put it out again. If it happens twice, then I know I've got a rig issue, because with an R3 in speed sensing, the occurrence is definitely at the lead. So if it happens twice, I know I've got length and shorten the hook length, put heavy lead on whatever. And you know, it's your ears underwater. You know, so you need a decent rig, you need indication in the rig to transmit back to your alarm. So you've got the whole three elements need to be working for you to nail every fish that's possible.
That is important. You know, it's. As I said on the other carpcast that I did when we spoke about indication, you know, 90% of the anglers that you see on the bank these days, the indication is completely, you know, it's not far off, locked up, there's no movement. You know, a lot of people think that indication, as Kevin was saying then, a lot of people think indication is only there to let you know when there's a fish hooked. Well, no, it's not. It's to let you know when there's something happening, whether it's, you know, whether it's a fish that has got away with it, or whether it's a line bites, for instance. You know, I fish for line bites. You know, you see my setup, I've got quite a long drop on my indicators. There's a lot of movement. It's got a lot of movement before the line tightens, it gets up to the top, and then the fish starts to feel resistance. You know, interesting talking about the running leads, what Kev was saying there is, our friend Eddie and Dave, who both fish Stone Acres, you know, Eddie tells me all the time about, you know, they go out in the boat, they drop the 6, 7, sometimes 8 ounce rigs they're dropping, and they're saying they leave the hook baits out for 2-3 days, and then they'll go back out, all the bait's gone, the rig's been picked up, it's been moved, I don't know, 3-6 foot and plonked into the nearest weed bed, and they never got a bleed. Now obviously if he was using a running lead, if he's using a running lead and you've got a adequate indication, so the way you've set your whole indication
and you listen to it
and you understand it, then you would get bleeps, because obviously the lead will stay put, and the fish tries to do that, you get your indication off it.
I've heard that story so many times.
It amazes me.
From boat anglers.
Eddie tells me that, and I'm thinking, well, how can a fish pick a lead up? You know, an 8 ounce lead up, move it 6 foot, you know, and you know, it's a and heavy thing.
I've never had that.
Remember, we filmed it, I can't remember what it was on, we filmed it, and this started me, I was doing some indication tests with Adam, and we was going down the track, you know, 50 yards. And I was lifting the lead off the ground, shouting, "Have you got a bleep?" He said, "No." And I was swinging it left to right, like 10 yards or whatever. No, he didn't get a bleep back on the indicator, head. Yeah.
I know, I've had my indication tested. I've had Rob Hughes for a feature and Carpology. I've had him swim out to my spot at like 60, 70 yards and test it. He has his test where he pulls your rig up his arm, he measures it, and the distance he pulled his rig up my arm, my bobbin moved the same distance.
And now
obviously there's mitigating factors. Sometimes you've got weed in between you and the spot and stuff. This wasn't clean, you know, there was weed between me and the spot, but it wasn't like thick Canadian or anything. It was manageable. I knew my line was straight between, you know, my lead and me. It was a straight line. But I've always felt like that, as I know you have. You've always took care with your indication, haven't you? But I know what's happening with my bobbin when it moves. I can normally tell if it's a fish that swum into the line somewhere, and I can normally tell you how far from my rod tip to the hook bait that I actually think the occurrence has happened, because that's usually the speed of it. You know, if you get a really quick one, we've all had it where we've had pike hit the lines in the edge, haven't we, when they're chasing stuff about, especially this time of year and stuff. You get it, don't you, in the spring as well. You get the pike striking and whatever, and you know, because it's super quick, it's like it's really agitated sort of bobbing. You know, if you get the really slow liner that's like 4 or 5 beeps up and then 4 or 5 beats down, settles back in exactly. I've seen it, I've been stumped by the rods where you can actually see the bow in your line,
yeah,
where a fish has caught it, you know, on its back or wherever it's caught it, and you can see it and your bobbin's tightening up slowly and you're looking at the line thinking, why is my line pointing that way? And then all of a sudden it'll drop back, your bobbin will drop all the way down, you see the line tighten up again, and you know something's caught it somewhere between you and the spot. And I've had enough practice with my bobbins to know that I can usually tell you the distance out the fish was. So if I'm fishing at 50 yards and it's really quick, I know it's probably happened in the first 10 yards between my rod tip and the occurrence. If it's a really slow one, sometimes you get those 2 beeps up, 1 beep just back down where it's not settled all the way back down. Quite often that's near your lead, that's almost a bite about to happen. It's maybe just picked up your leader, as it's, you know, nosing around your spot picking your bait. Or quite often when you get that one, like you get the 2 bleeps bleep back,
not long after you might get some,
you get a bite, yeah, you know. Because it the occurrence has happened near the spot. The faster it is, normally the closer to the bank, the slower it is, the closer to your spot. And if it doesn't drop all the way back, it's almost certainly on your spot, because you know, the resistance of the line for 60 yards out, 70 yards out has not let it go all the way back. But I'm really confident in my indication. I've had it tested, like I say, with Rob Hughes. We've spent 10 years talking about indication, haven't we? And you know, I know you're even more,
well, as you say, you know, sometimes you might get to, you know, four bleeps up, 4 bleeps down, and or different variations of that. But how many people do you see on the bank when you walk around different fishing lakes and they've got the rods as low to the floor as they get? You know, some lads have even got the reels touching the floor, and then they've got just a little tiny trot on the bobbin.
Yeah.
So they've got no movement. You know,
they're never finding out half the stuff we're seeing.
I was amazed to find out the term for how I've fished for 40 years is called semi-tight. I think that's the term.
Yeah.
Semi-tight means you've got something like a 9-12 inch drop on your bottom with the ability for it to also drop another 9-12 inches. Yeah. I think I've been told that's semi-tight. Nice,
yeah,
to know.
And a reasonable weight in your bobbin, so it can go both ways.
A reasonable weight in your bobbin,
And the line's under its own resistance of your bobbin,
basically. Roger, the number of these silly 3 or 4 inch chains we sell. Yeah. Slight amount of movement, it's tight against the blank, you know, just no indication.
Even worse, the indications, like where people
use like the stow bobbins for all round indication, whereas they get a liner, it goes up two beeps on the short chain and then it pings out the thingy, it pings out the clip, and their bobbins hung down. They've no idea if they've just had a take or a line back.
It's the middle of the night, they're using,
they just don't know what's happened.
They've backed their heads off as well, so
yeah,
it's windy.
I see that happen all the time, and I've been with people, you know, and they're using that setup. They all look cool. I mean, it's a trend, isn't it? The 2-3 inch chains, the bobbins right up against the buzzer, and quite often the stow bobbins or something that's clipped in. They get a two beat liner sometimes pings it out of the clip, and they're sat there and they're going, "Have I just had a bite?" Because it can't ever drop back because the bobbin's gone now. It's for me, it's the most. It's the perfect example of fashion over function.
They need to make a setup where, okay, you know, we're given, they don't have the real handles on the wheels, they leave the real handles off the wheels, but they need to have a setup that looks cool with the bobbins
set. Yeah, don't get me wrong, I look at some people's set up and think they look really nice, you know, we're all really tight, but
it looks great.
Yours looks the opposite, doesn't it, Roger? Yeah. You have your reels at waist height almost, don't you, in most swims? Your rod's really high up, big long drop on the bobbins. Mm. You know, but it might look kind of clunky, but it's efficient.
It definitely does.
It tells you everything that happens. You know, I've been in your swim loads of times when you've had bites and I've stood, and the amount of extra indication you get before you get the bite is unreal. You quite often will get that beat, one up, one down, and then something else will happen, and then you get the screamer, whereas everybody else is missing that first bit and they're just getting the screamer.
I've had kids walk in my swim, I've got rods pointing all different angles, the right height, and they walk in and they're almost disappointed. You just see they're disgusted there because I'm not looking cool.
Yeah, I've always used separate bank sticks for that reason as well. The rods are pointed all over the place, and it's like you say, it's practical first before. It's great if you can be practical and have everything look nice. I mean, you're making a living out of selling very stylish tackle, Kevin. So, you know, and you sell short chains as well, but that's a demand because people want them.
Lovely story. Gary Bowes was fishing one of the canals in Belgium once with his Belgian guy, and it was the second morning, and he was starving. He wanted to go down the Baker's, so he's gone up to his Belgian guys, 400 or 500 yards up the bank, and he said to him, "Can you watch me tackle? I'm going down the Baker's." The guy turned around and said, "Gary, you could leave your tackle here for a year and I'm going to steal it."
I can vouch for that. I've seen basic fishing. I don't know. I mean, we've moved on to indication there, but I mean,
it's a very big part of rigs. In my, it's not, but you know, without indication, you know, the rigs ain't going to work for them half the time. They're not understanding what's happening at the rig end. So I really think it is part of
that's the
subject.
That's the key point. Yeah, is, you know, some people might be listening to this saying, "Well, if it's going to rip off anyway after all these beeps, then why do I need to know the bit?"
But don't rip off.
What about the times when it doesn't rip off, or the times where you get all that you know, one up, one down, you know there's something on your spot, and then it doesn't rip and you didn't get the bite for whatever reason? So have you been done? Did they suss your rig out? You know, did something spook them on the spot? Like, I want to know every single little thing.
Yeah, you want to know exactly what's that. I mean,
I also want to know if there's just nothing in my swim.
Exactly. It's not just about catching a fish. That line bite an hour or two just before you're about to leave and go home might make you stay an extra couple of hours or not move a peg and eventually catch something
because something's
happening in your peg.
Yeah, and again, because of your indication, you know roughly what that is that's happened. You know if it could be a pike in the edge or a line bite from something close in. I mean, how many times have you actually been fishing at a certain distance and you've been picking up indication, but your confidence not on your spot? You've brought it back nearer to the bank because of something that's happened, and then caught maybe 30 yards closer than what you ought to be fishing. I mean, I remember on Elster 1 that happened to me one time where the fish were closer in, kept getting lined. The swim that was full of weed that nobody fished a bit further around from the point where the haggler was. What was the next swim that hardly anyone fished? I remember being there one time and I kept getting liners, but I was sure it wasn't on the spot.
It was the island. They had some sunken islands out there on this one.
Yeah, something like that. Anyway, I ended up bringing it in another, like, I found the spot halfway between me and the spot I was fishing, and then I started picking up fish.
That's the experience, ain't it, Johnny? You know, so, yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah, but if I'd been clipped up tight or whatever,
no,
I'd have never read
what
that.
What I'm saying, you know, you're talking about a level of experience that's sadly a lot of these kids aren't up to that yet, but incidentally R3, it's got three settings. It's only the middle and the last one that are speed sensing. The first setting is ultimate sensitivity, you know, and the alarm is most sensitive, and that hasn't got speed sensing. So, you know, I designed it so I could pick up line bites, like you were saying. You know, I wonder how many anglers, point I'm making is, they're getting bleeps at our line bites. They identify their line bites, and then they will bring the rig back to try and find the zone where they carve
bites. There's certain alarms. I mean, all alarms back in the day used to just work on sheer movement with no computer in them, no line sensing, no nothing. So you were used to beeps constantly, weren't you? If the wind got up, if anything, they were just constantly beeping. Now, some people still choose to use alarms that beep all the time. You know, most notorious being dealt with.
They scream off, didn't they?
Yeah. Yeah, you could get away with it. So you'd listen to those beeps and you'd know that it's the waves lapping your rods or whatever, and all of a sudden something out of the ordinary would happen, like a shorter spurt of beeps or something. You'd know that something different other than the beeps that you'd tuned your brain to not, you know, get excited by. But I mean, all buzzers did that back in the day. I mean, you know, Dalkims are probably the worst for false beeping, aren't they? And everyone I know that's got Dalkims, they like the Dalkims, but they just get used to the beeps, and whenever they use another alarm now, or a better alarm, or the Nashes, or they're like, oh, they don't beep. You know, it's like all these sort of wind beeps, everything have just vanished. But
I do wonder, actually, it's almost like a comfort zone for them. You know, they've got so used to hearing bleeps. If they do a day with no bleeps, it would destroy them.
It's one of those things, until you've had it. Yeah, I don't want to make it sound like an R3 advert. Obviously, you've found a way of cutting out the nuisance beeps. Fox have done something on their top of the range alarms. As expensive as they are, they do cut out, you know, again, when they beep, something's happened. As a rule, that they found a way of doing it with some sort of computer. It memorises the consistencies and then tells you when something's not that consistent. I don't know exactly how they work, but the point is they find a way around it, you find a way around it. Every other alarm is just beeps constantly, all day long.
But the other key point is to deal with the adverse conditions, they back off the sensitivity. So in essence, there's more movement,
yeah.
Movement between indication, which a certain alarm I won't mention because it's not professional. You know, that is 6 inches. Well, you know, these carp nudging a lead or whatever, picking it up, they're not giving anything like that amount of indication. You know, so you're sitting there in the wind thinking, oh, I've backed it off, I'm fishing properly and I've got good indication. Well, you still haven't, because, you know, you haven't got sufficient the small amount of movement you need to indicate, you know, because you've backed it off so much.
So getting back to rigs, if we let's take an idyllic situation. You've got fish that aren't pressured, so they haven't been conditioned to adjust how they feed or how they deal with rigs. They haven't been conditioned. You found the mysterious lake full of 40-pound carp and they've never been fished for. So, first of all, we've got a clean bottom, so we can present perfectly pretty much anything we want. So what type of hooking arrangement are you going to have, from blowback to ring to... Everything's on the table. You can use any length of hook link. You can use any lead clip arrangement or running lead. You can use chod rig. What would be your first choice for a fish that hasn't learned anything?
Yeah, I think if like you say, they've not been fished for before, I wouldn't use anything. I'd use a straight bottom bait, straight on. If it's a clean bottom, I'd just use a bottom bait, a bog standard, knotless knot.
Off the eye.
Maybe carry through, you know, carry through to the hair. It's made from the hook length material. Standard's probably eight inch hook length.
So do you think that rig is the most effective rig to hook a carp? Why would you not use the most effective rig you've ever come across to hook a carp, even though this fish has not been fished for?
Because I don't think it's necessary. I just think that, you know, the fish are feeding as they would. It would feel something in its mouth, it'd eject it,
Something, it's not expecting it to be danger, is it? That's my point here. If we're fishing for a completely virgin carp, even if it feels something, it doesn't know it's a hook and they're going to get dragged in and have the picture taken. They don't know, do they?
Yeah, but sometimes what I'm saying is, when you get a fish that doesn't know it's being fished for, then it's not used to having something in its mouth. It's not used to feeling something different. So when it does bolt. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Whereas the ones that are clued up and have been fished for, they've learnt that when they do feel that something in the mouth, something, they recognise it, and they also recognise, I'm not going to vacate the area as an instinct. I'm going to stay, and I'm going to suck and blow, and I'm going to shake my head. I don't think the ones that the virgin fish, they don't do
that. They just instantly react. And
they just instantly react.
Which is why we all used to get screamers in the early days.
Yeah.
But, so you still think mechanically, the actual physical angle of the hook hanging below the bait when they suck it in, just a hair straight off the eye or knotless knot off the back, you know, near to the eye, you think that's probably going to be the mechanically most effective, you know, to set the hook in the fish's mouth?
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, sometimes you think that, you know, if you were to have your hair just coming straight from the eye, I mean, no ring on it,
KD style,
because obviously if and when a fish blows, then again it's going to pull the hook out eye first, rather than turning it around. Do you know what I mean?
And then when they suck the hook bait up, the hook's hanging down on the bottom lip anyway, pretty much, isn't it? I'm starting to think more. Think about this: is that a KD rig is one of the most effective rigs there is? Because
you know what, I disagree entirely.
Okay, let's move on to your idyllic situation.
More or less, I am absolutely in agreement with Roger. Point being, keep it simple, keep it strong. Why? Waste your time messing about with fancy rigs if you don't need them. I'll use the word fancy. The mechanics is a key element, and where I'm saying I disagree, when I did all those massive rig trials years ago, I come across a palm test where I was just hand sharpening my hooks in the mid 90s, and I started dragging the hook link across my hand, and the hook would turn and prick, right? And the eyeliner to kicking out the bottom, little bit of tube, I was getting the hook to turn over 1.5 inches from the heel of my hand. And it really shocked me at the time that I noticed I was getting the hook holes in the same place. I say shocked me, because prior to that, we always used to hook the carp around the lips. And so I assumed that's as far back as they took it in. It was only after that period of all the blowback rig experiments and all that, that I started getting these deeper back hook holes. And the point was, every rig before it was cast out had my palm test, because sometimes the hook wouldn't turn over and stick in my palm. It might get to the heel of your hand before it did. It might even fall off. And I look at those rigs, and often I couldn't really see a difference. Do me a head why, but the key point I'm making is that if I got that hook to turn over straight away, it was tensioned, I hooked those carp
further deep back,
right? And that was with basically the tube at the top of the bend, I would say. Yeah, I think the best place for a hook to turn is centre of the bend, the original head.
Is that not relying on the
movement
on the boilie on your hand? Like, obviously, when you're pulling that on the palm test, which doesn't happen in a real situation, I don't think, is some of that turning of effectivity is coming from the size of the boilie. Yeah, that's holding your hook in a certain way.
Not necessarily the size of the boilie, because that can be changed, or the influence that gets around that is the distance between the bend of the hook and the back of the body. But getting back to what I'm saying, the separation, in my opinion, the best point to get that hook to turn is centre bend, but it's also the easiest point for the carp to suck it out. And so bring the pivot point up to the top of the bend, use a blowback tube, knotless knot. Like Roger says, just a damn good hook link of mine will always be armour braid in that situation, because it's such abrasion resistance. It's got a little bit element of stiffness in it also that I love. And Roger said 8 inches, I say 8 to 9.5. And all the experiments I did at that time, by the way, it was 8 to 9.5. If I fished short hook links, I went down to 2, 3. The catch rate, the take rate massively dropped, but more importantly, the size of them dropped. Yeah, you know, I found it really interesting. Fish. Roger said 8. I say 8 to 9.5. You know. You'll see Danny saying 4 inches or something. Yeah, you know, but I've never found it. But the key point I want to make, I did a massive amount of testing and experimentation then, and it was always comparing one rod against another. It wasn't theory.
Yeah.
It was two rods tight on the spot,
yeah,
and the one that would go, I'd then bring the other in and turn them around, even if they're only a foot apart. Yeah. So what I learned then was based on the number of takes.
Yeah. Yeah, I've always done that with the experiment. I've done a lot of testing between like stiff links and sort of snowman rigs, you know, on the same spot.
Where I was going on from that, I played around with rigs just tying by the eye, you know, the hair coming off from the eye, and I just never converted the takes. I got the takes like I did with having that bit of chew up the top.
Yeah.
And that's the only point I was making. Like, I didn't get the results with KD type rigs that I did having that bit of tube right up there.
I used tube for a lot of years, and I found the same thing, that it was actually better off the top of the bend as opposed to halfway round the bend. But Roger got me thinking the other week when we were talking, obviously when you're pinning using silicone or blowback tubing, when you're pinning the hair to a point that's, you know, somewhere down the hook, when the fish blows it out, it's going to pull it out bend first, as opposed to, you know, being able to when they blow, unless you tighten up to the hook.
No, mate, it's already too late. You know, this is about keeping it in.
Yeah.
You know, as I say.
Once it's already pricked itself.
Once it's pricked itself. So you've got to get away from that straight line for the centre of the hook, because when it sucks, it just comes straight out. When you bring it to the back, that means when they suck, it's pivoting.
Yeah.
So it might still stay in.
Yeah.
You know, and so the danger is when you're bringing it round the bend, but the reason I'm saying that's my basic going away rig, because I've got the hook turning going in quick, and then the tube can slide back.
Yeah.
Yeah, so my blowback tube rig is my most basic rig. So they prick themselves, then when they blow, it pulls it back down, and then suck, and it's down by the eye, so that the point's pivoting, staying in the flesh.
But what I've done is my work around, from what I've been thinking of, as I'm still fishing that rig, but I'm using the ring again, which I used to do years ago, using the ring instead of the blowback tubing, but I'm having the ring down by the top of the bend, basically, the bottom of the shank.
As far down
top
as you
of the
can.
Bend. Yeah, as far down as you can without it going round.
It was only going to be effective if it can go over the eye. Otherwise, you might as well use the tube. Because if they can suck it back up, they'll do you if they're pressured. That's what I'm saying. They can't go back up, Jamie. Yeah, see what I mean? Blow, it comes down, pulls it, nails it in your hope a bit, but then if they suck, they bring it up to a position where they can pull the point out. The further you have it around that bend towards that centre, the more chance they're going to do that.
I'd never thought about them using
the second suck.
The second suck. Yeah. I've thought about it loads.
No, that's it. The second suck is everything.
The second suck is.
I'll have to put that in the book then.
It's a song, isn't it? The second suck is the hardest.
And really, I don't think many angels are getting it even.
To be fair, I've never thought about that.
No. We're doing everything off the first suck and blow, as if there is only ever one suck and blow. And there obviously isn't. I've seen them do it double time, all the quarter videos, the underwater ones. I've seen them, you know, when they're bolting and they prick themselves and they're trying to get off, it's not just one out, I don't think.
And I was looking
at how I sussed it was from the tube blowback rig, when those cops fish started doing me on it, and I'm bewildered, what the fuck? Yeah, so it's only because all those years of using that tube blowback, and then I'm being done, that it made me think. It's just now I've named it the second suck.
Well, can you just clarify for me, Kevin? Because when you say this tube blowback rig, do you mean you've got tube that will still slide up and down?
Yeah, it's
up and down the shank of the hook.
Exactly, it's telltale. Yeah.
So, but it is tight enough to hold itself in a position. It's not free-running like a ring.
No, it's tight.
It's, you know, it grips the shank. Right? When you tie one, you need to tie it wet to make sure you've got the right grip, because obviously the tube diameter is dependent on the thick wire. But in short, use 1mm rig tube, and that does most sizes. Yeah, so you get element of grip on the shank, right? But then when they blow, it comes down to the knot.
Right.
Right? You've got your telltale, but unless they're really pressured, that doesn't. But, you know, in recent years, that rig has stopped working because I identified the tube wasn't going far enough back, so they could then suck and pull it out. So I went back to my original ring rig, which was a 4mm ring that went back over the eye, and they can suck all day long, but they're never going to get that back up the hook.
So when you say, they blow it back over the eye, did he blow it back over the eye to a position, to a stop, something that stops it, or does it just...
It just goes to the length of the hair,
right? Or can it go the length of the
hook? It's gone over the eye, and because of the distance the ring's up the hook link, sorry, up the hook, is probably what, an inch below the eye or whatever? See right. What I mean? So the ring has ended up half inch, three quarters, an inch, whatever, but down the hook link.
Right, but so has it hit something then? Has it been stopped by something? No.
Yeah,
just a length of the
knot attached to the eye.
Right, right.
Yeah? So you can't do it. I never tied it with a knotless knot because that gets in the way. I used to tie a grinner off the eye of the hook so it got easy exit over. And, really, I've just got lazy. So I started tying it with a knotless knot so then just come back to the knot and then so the tube. But. If really, I've gone back all that time now, so it's doing exactly the same as your D rig set board. They can't suck it back up. Mm. So there's no way they can get the angle of the bait to pull the hook out.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've never thought about this before, so I don't know how often they are trying to suck the hook back out using the boiling.
By the way, Roger, where. Probably aren't well, it was by accident. The way I tied it, the bait used to go back on the ring and jam at the back of the D-rig.
Yeah.
I'm not sure whether yours does that, does it?
No.
Yeah, that could be worth experimenting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So make it so when the ring goes back, it's pinched by the end of the D-rig.
And
so
it can't hold it back grips up. It.
Yeah,
well, you do yours quite tight anyway. I've always wondered if they, once they have been blown out, whether they actually can reset back over the eye of the hook again, because yours are like tram lines, aren't they?
Yeah, they're very quite tight to the hook itself. On the official Carpcast page that some lad was...
Yeah. See, I've thought about your rig of actually not having the D and actually putting... So, say you're using a stiff section to your hook, like a stiff link...
Mm.
Actually having the hook bait on the hook link as opposed to on a D, like have a pop-up using a screwing pop-up thing or whatever,
so
a ring swivel.
So it pops up to the eye.
We're going to pop up.
And then when they blow it, it's just sliding down the actual hook link as opposed to...
Yeah, with pop-ups, obviously, it's a lot easier.
Mm. Yeah, but when you couldn't do it in a bomb bait.
Yeah. I think... Yeah, when I said about this little Tiffy Paisley... Where he mistranslated my ring blowback rig, he made sure the ring, if it slid back down, went back up and corrected itself, because he had this thing in his head about nuisance fish, whacking it down. But it rarely happens, if ever happens.
Yeah.
They may mess around with it, but they seem to grip or whatever, so it's always up the hook. I've never felt that it's costing me fish because I'm being done by nuisance fish and it's ending up fishing ineffectively. But if in any doubt, just have a buoyant bait, that's where I was going.
Mm.
And it's always naturally going to bring it up to the
reset
itself.
So going back to the imperfect scenarios, is it an 8-inch hook link would you go for in an unpressured fish situation? Fishing for big carp, 40-pound carp that I've been fished for, are you using an 8-inch hook link?
On clean, hard sand, gravel, clay, bottom, yeah.
So you're using a knotless knot or KD rig straight off the eye. A wide gape hook, pretty wide as possible.
Normal wide gape hook. I always do tend to favour wide gape hooks.
Straight point, beat point.
I always use beat points, but saying that, I have in the last few sort of months been looking at the straight point hooks and starting to think about should I really start incorporating them to some of my rigs because they're interesting. I like the mechanics of the way they work.
Yeah, I've never liked beat point hooks. I always think you're like hindering yourself a little bit on the pricking, but I know a lot of people who fish gravel pits they you know, straight point hooked the cassette out once and the hook, the point's gone over. So yeah. I always thought that that's the only real reason to use beat point hooks.
I mean, some of the beat point hooks that I use now, I get hand sharpened by a friend and it straightens the point up. Yeah. So you kind of almost get in the best of both worlds.
Yeah. What are your thoughts there, Kevin? Beat point hooks and straight point hooks?
Listeners note, Nashy went to have a pee, so he didn't understand the question. Just come back gobsmacked because I heard, got the impression that Roger was saying he likes beak point hooks. But then you get them sharp and it straightens the point out. Yeah. So is it a beak or not?
Beak points are perfect for sharpening.
They are perfect, yeah.
In short, I just don't get it because initial pricking is going to be impacted.
Yeah, you're obviously physically once hindering
in.
Yourself. Yeah,
once they're in, they're in. Much better, but you're
not getting them in as often. No. The only reason I see, you know, fish with a lot of gravel pits in the south, and it doesn't turn the points over. And I understand the physics that you maybe give up on a little bit of hooking just to know you've still got a point after one cast.
I'd want the point, mate. So I wouldn't use a bottom bait. I'd use something where if I'm pulling back or whatever, my hook's lifted off the bottom.
Yeah.
Or every time you're winding, you just set the fact you've got to put another hook on.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the reasons why John Mack did his interchangeable hook rig that's now kind of known as a multi-rig, for that very reason, fishing those gravel pits down there. It was, you know, so you could change the... Because basically, every time you reeled in, if you're fishing gravel, you know, every time you reeled in, the point was over.
Is anything more important than a super sharp hook? A super, 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 super sharp hook? Is anything more important, Roger?
Not that I know.
No. It's been one of the greatest edges for the anglers that knew about it before the masses, about you know, for years, hasn't it? You know,
yeah. And we did get some very sharp out the pack hooks. You know, as technology got better and hook manufacturing got better, there is a lot of sharp hooks out there. Nothing comes close to a sharpened hook.
I mean, I used to
hand sharpened hook.
I used to think, you know, the hooks I used to use were great, but now I literally could not put a hook straight out of the packet onto a rig.
How does that feel from a manufacturing point of view, Kevin?
I'm with him. The technology is not available. You know, it's not. There's nothing between the manufacturers or qualities. The technology is not available to sharpen a hook by any mechanical method or acid that it is by hand.
So we need Nash hook sharpening kits, don't we?
Well, yes and no. There's a lot of anglers. They, I suggest, they'd be better off using it straight out of the packet because they just kill the hook. They try and sharpen it.
It's a skill, isn't it? Not everybody can sharpen hooks.
It's definitely a skill, and I can do it, but I don't. You know, I've got someone that I give. I mean, shout out to Mike Harry Potter who sharpens all my hooks, and he does a great job. You know, he does my hooks for me.
You just give him a load of pack of hooks, and away he goes.
And, you know,
but let's be clear: there's two things. There's honing a hook out of a packet.
Yeah, which, that's what I do.
Yeah, which
I don't.
Which most
and
people,
I hold.
Yeah, go along to a carp show, you know, talk to Dean, and he will give you some tips on how you can lap and hone a hook. So I mean, get out of a pocket, it's a bit sharper. And then there is hand sharpening. That is a real skill.
Yeah,
because you are removing metal, and if the average guy without, you know, any engineering experience tries to remove metal, you end up making a pig's ear of it. So learn to hone them. But you know, unless you really do have the ability, don't start removing metal and hand sharpening.
No, I touch them up with a stone, that's it. Mm. But the last lot I had actually were a load of twisters. I always use twister for every type of rig, pretty much. Mark from Pinpoint Hooks, he gave me a load of twisters. Oh. Well, he gave me two packets actually. Two packs of the chod twisters, two packs of the normal ones that he'd sharpened. And I'm still using those hooks now. I just touch them up with a stone, and I can reuse those hooks sessions on it. I've been using them since January. You know, two packets of hooks.
What did they sharpen up like, the twisters? Because that's a pattern of hook that I've been thinking of changing to.
It's very hard to sharpen them unless you know what you're doing.
Exactly,
he does them perfectly, but I think he has a machine, doesn't he?
No,
he doesn't buy
a machine.
Actual hand.
Doesn't buy hand. He does 400 a day.
Wow.
8 hours.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well,
tip, Roger, get hold of Mark and get him to send you over some hand sharpened twisters, pal. You will be impressed.
Yeah. I mean, twisters.
I wouldn't use anything other than pinpoint, hand sharp, and twisters.
Yeah, I'm happy using twisters out the pack and just touch with my stone. I mean, that is, I've found more success with twisters just using the stone on, because it's really hard to mess them up with the stone, because they are quite a fine point anyway.
Can I congratulate the boys at Fox here?
Go on.
For recognising that the twister is the best hook in the world, because they just copied it, I understand.
Shots fired.
Lewis, what you got to say about that, Mr. Poulter?
Well, as we've spoke about many times before, sometimes something is done the right way and everybody has to follow suit. So, no, I mean, I've used many hook patterns over the years. Thankfully, the twister covers every type of situation I like, and I've used, since the day you brought them out, which is quite a lot of years ago now, isn't it? I've never used another hook.
I was just thinking, me and Jim Gibson got together and designed a range of hooks. This is very early 90s, called them pattern 1, 2, I can't remember how many went, 3, 4, 5 maybe.
I used to use them. Yeah. I think it was the pattern 2, was it quite a long shank.
It's funny you say that, I'll go back to that. Pattern 1 was like these short shank curvy owner.
That's right.
And yeah, that was always going to be the biggest seller. But pattern 2 was a hook that me and Jim wanted to do, and we called it the ugly hook. Because it had all the rig, all the hook mechanics we wanted.
A slightly inturned eye, do you have?
Hmm?
You have a slightly inturned eye.
I'll be back to you in a minute, Roger. Right? Then we did 3, whatever that was. But you know, throughout my tackle development years, I've often brought a product out because I want it and blow the sales. So you know, we reckon we had enough sales in 1 and 2 to pay for 3 that wouldn't sell because of the ugly hook.
Yeah.
That is a twister today.
Right, yeah. With a slightly interned eye.
Well, it had an interned eye then. It's basically the pattern 2 is exactly, almost as that copy of the twister today.
But the pattern 2 had a round bend rather than the twisters go round. Yeah, it has a bit of an angle down there at the end.
Yeah, that downturned eye, boring, you know, a little bit longer.
Yeah, straight hook, it wasn't offset.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's something I've never got my head round, offset hooks, where the points pointing sideways, you know what I mean? So if you laid it flat on the table, it's the hook's raised, it doesn't lay flat on the table. I've always thought that that's probably more effective 50% of the time, and if it's, you know, if it happens to be pointing the other way when it's sucked in, it's less effective. It's going to prick one side more than the other side.
I always tend to go for straight. I mean, it was like what's his name? He's fishing at the minute.
True.
Yeah, he was talking about the circle hooks he mentioned when he was, last night when he was fishing for, one of the lads was saying he fishes for sharks and they don't use circle hooks and the fish just drop off. But yeah, with these circle hooks, Drew was saying, put a circle hook on and you never lose a fish.
Yeah.
Well, you won't, will you?
Yeah.
That's why they use them on long lines.
Yeah.
Yeah, because once it's just an advance on a beak hook, isn't it?
Yeah.
Once it's actually nailed, you know, it's just driving it around more and more. It's almost the same as a bent hook, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which is why they're out, because the damn things would come right out and end up double hooking.
Double hook, yeah.
Yeah, I find it interesting that it's called as Gura, isn't it? Their match brand. They promote circle hooks and match fishing there. So I can only get from that once they've hooked whatever they're hooking in their matches, it's hung. It just, the circle hook just helps keep it on more and more. Yeah.
I've never done any sort of sea fishing, shark fish or anything, so I've never even heard of a circle hook.
Primarily all the long lines have them on.
Yeah.
So literally, you know, it's not literally, but you know, it's creating a circle almost. So once they are nailed on it, it just rides more and more in.
How's a fish going to hook itself on that? You just don't look like it would work. But
it's really got a bite into it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is it the same principle as our tightening up to the lead type scenario with the rigs that we use? I mean, Ethan, everybody knows what a withy pole rig looks like, which I could never get my head round. So it that's almost a circle, isn't it? They're making over half a circle.
Not far away, is it?
Sorry?
A chod's not far away.
No, it's very similar. So
withy pole was really the first chod rig, wasn't it? Yeah. Other than the fact it's not on a lump of lead.
I've still never really, but I'm assuming the effectiveness of those is holding the hook in once it's been hooked. But it's relying on being hooked. I mean, because if you're holding a withy pull rig, you can pull it across your hand and it's not going to hook you, is it?
Yeah, but with those pop-ups, you can't use a palm test. Mainly had a test for his finger.
Yeah.
For pop, and funny enough, it was from that test that I realised obviously it couldn't work with a bottom bait rig, and that's how I come up with the palm test. But say with a pop up rig, you know, sticks, you know, drag it across your finger, don't you?
Yeah.
Because that is on the lips, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm. Palm test for bottom bait rigs, finger test for pop-ups.
I've never got my head around the palm test. It's not something that I've used much as a gauge to see how effective the rig is.
Why don't you try it then, Realtor, and report back?
I always find it can't ever do any harm, because if your palm is like the bottom of a fish's mouth and you can get a rig that grabs it within 3 mil rather than 3 inches, then that rig has got to be more effective. Now, how often does that exact scenario come up when a fish has sucked a bait in is up for question, I think. You know, how often is your hook laid flat on the base of the fish's mouth with the boilie laid flat on the back of the fish's mouth behind it? I don't know if that ever happens.
With the hook length going out, flat, going outside the fish's mouth, and then
the fish is always above the rig, isn't it? Because it's tipped up to feed. So I do think that's realistic. So if you're holding your palm here and you're pulling it across with the hook link slightly below your palm, then I think that probably is realistic to your rig. The bit that I don't think is obviously when you're testing it with the boilie, you know, with the shrink tubing right round. I don't think that has any effects. I think the boil is actually in the air when the fish has sucked it in. Even if your hook is laid flat on the fish's mouth, I think the boil is elevated from that.
This is one of them, isn't it, where, you know,
how can
series being applied rather than, like I said,
yeah,
the physical thing was to me that, you know, where my hook turns straight, where my palm maybe an inch half back, oh my God, I'm getting the hook holes exactly the same distance back in the mouth.
Yeah, I mean,
and that's where the hook link, because, you know, I used to pride myself in trying to get inch and a half back, bottom lip centre. Because the other thing to get bottom lip centre is entirely dependent on the length of your hook link. Too short, and they probably won't be hooked. Too long, and you get hook them in the scissors because they turn. So I used to, you know, I got it as such a craft. I wanted inch and a half back, bottom lip centre.
I hadn't really thought of that with longer hook links, catch them in the scissors. I always just thought of some mechanics
hook link links now.
Of which way the fish approaches your spot from, and you know, it's automatic reaction which way it's going to bolt. It's probably going to bolt.
You're giving too much play to hang themselves, and they might blow that rig out in the process.
Somebody asked that question on Carbcast recently. They were hooking all the fish in the scissors, and my answer was, well, you ain't got no problem, you're hooking them. But I was probably wrong, because it should have been shorting your hook link a little bit, because you're giving them too much play.
Yeah. Well, I always think that, you know, the nearer to the very outside of the mouth, the lips, you know, you are hooking the fish, then
the less effective.
The less effective it is. I mean, when I first started using the pop-up extended D-rig that I used, and Jason started using it with me on Deadman's, you know, it was a bit of a, you know, some of the times we'd land a fish and it was like, oh my God, just come and have a look where this fish is hooked, and the whole D was, you know, you couldn't reach it with your fingers. The forceps had to start coming out for the first time in years. You have to get the forceps out to look inside with a torch and find the hook, because it's going back and it's right at the point of furthest it's doing its job there.
Well, I had 3 fish on here last week, one out of Church and 2 out of Cops. Everyone was a long way, inch and a half to 2 inch back. I remember telling you, didn't I, on the phone, that they were all nailed. Now I had Frank Warwick's anchor rig, using my normal blowback. I've actually, the only changes I've made is I've gone back to the ring from the tubing, but I've put the anchor through it, which basically, when you put the anchor rig, the palm test, you 9 out of 10 you can't get it more than 3 mil before it grabs, just because the anchor's
just on a twister hook still. Yeah,
on a twister. Yeah, I always use the twister for that. And every one of those fish was inch and a half to 2 inch back. Now, I remember saying to you, the fish are just feeding really confidently because the weather's good. I didn't put it down to the rear. I know that the anchor rig makes it grab way quicker than not having the anchor.
Yeah.
I mean, them twisters, they grab pretty well anyway. If you put shrink tube in a line on it, they grab anyway.
So when you mentioned anchor before, I thought you meant he's using every weight. It's called anchor. Are you talking about?
I'm talking about
what Frank used to call years ago, a little bit of
stiff bristle
going through the side crossways of the tubing. Yeah.
Oh wow, he's still doing that, is he?
Yeah. Well, that's what I had all the fish on last week. Mm.
Frank's still been using that on the quiet all these years.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a really effective.
Yeah,
really
it just makes it great. Yeah. If you're doing the palm test, you will never, whatever rig you're confident in, put that bristle through and then do the palm test, it will grab quicker than what it is already. Just because it's physically sitting it up. As soon as you pull it, I mean, it's the reason why an anchor's an anchor.
Anchor rig, you drop it down because it grips the lake bait, it grips the sea bait instantly.
I've got to say that when I messed around originally, I never got me hooks to turn, but you know, I can't remember. That was probably when he first done it, which is pre my.
Yeah, I've got a couple lower, there if you want to down.
Play around
if you have a walk around in the morning, I'll let you do the palm test in a couple of mine. Even without a hook bait on, it grabs it instantly.
So, in short, Jamie, my process for a bit. If you think there's anything or not, I'll tie my rig, I'll put it across my palm, I'll get it the forming I want, then I'll put it out. I have a carp, the first thing I do is look at where that hook hold is. If, for example, with scissors or right on the tip of the lips, I'll adjust the hook link. And so I'm working on that process, then I'll get a bleep and hopefully it's nailed. If I two bleeps, I haven't got it nailed, then I'll scratch my edge. Which way do I go? I'll lengthen the hook link. Yeah, but that's the process I'm going for all the time. Palm test, checking each hook hold.
So if you're hooking them on the outside of the lips, your rig's too short, or the edge of the lips on that rubbery
bit.
You've
been bloody lucky. That's my view. How many times did you possibly suck it and not take the bait in?
Have you not found at different times of year? I'm mainly thinking of the spring here, early in the year when they're not feeding as confident, they're coming out of the winter. Do you find that you have a lot that are nicked then? I mean, the only times I ever lose fish really are that time of year, and I just put it down to them not feeding as hard.
I've never put down the time of year. As I said to you earlier, the hour, you know, particularly with the, you know, when I was using the running rigs, I might have to move that backstop two or three times in a session if I was catching a lot of fish. Just something's happening, you know, I don't know why. And then a little chat with each other, but you're suddenly going from getting nice steady takes to consistent lifts and bleeps that aren't converting. Pull that bead an inch nearer and then start again. An inch out and then start again. We used to see this at Layer in the 70s. You know, me and Zen used to really start with the craze. We used to have tackle boxes and we stuck a tape measure in it. You know, that's how the difference made. We might have to just adjust that hook link by half an inch. You know, and years later, they started moulding tape measures into tackle box lids. But that's how critical it was at Layer. You know, we might be catching 30, 40, what we call pasties a day now. But you know, half an inch can be the difference, you know, in an hour. And then you have to change it again. But so that's almost getting up to match anglers, adjusting everything.
I think we've done it. I think we've done rigs.
Well, just one more thing. Like you were saying, you were talking about the rigs for, you know, you tipped up at a lake. You tipped up at a lake and you were fishing that scenario. What would you do if you tipped up at a lake and it wasn't a clean bottom and you weren't quite sure about what it was like out there? You knew it was silty or there was...
I mean,
9 out of 10 anglers would just go straight to the chod, wouldn't they?
I don't go to the chard. I still like to fish the most effective way I've fished, which has been a blowback rig for a lot of years now, snowman type blowback rig. So I will generally protect the hook with a stick threaded down it, and I'll use a longer hook link. If that's not good enough for the type of bottom, it depends. I mean, I would normally try and find a spot. So what you're saying, if there's no clean spots anywhere, if you've looked everywhere, the fish are there, and you have to kind of make do on that bottom.
Or let's just say, for instance, you've pushed your barrow into a peg, there's this fish nutting out, and you've got no idea what it's like out there, but you want to do just a couple of casts.
Probably would put a chod on one of the rods.
Would you?
Most certainly. If there was already fish showing, and I had no idea, I'd risk a couple of casts with a smallish lead, see if I got a drop anywhere. If I got any sort of drop, I'd maybe put a PBA bag out with everything in it. I'd maybe put a chod rig out and I'd maybe try my normal sort of setup, snowman blowback style, with a stick protecting it and quite a long hook link. We've been talking about a different arrangement recently, haven't we, for I know some people that fish the Terry Hearn style stiff link, but using a coated braid boom, like quite a long boom, like a 7-8 inch boom, then plus the actual you know, the hooking end, the stiffling. I know people that have been using that, casting it into weed with some foam around it in place of a chod rig, and reckon, and then looked at it from a boat, and they've been saying that it's presented better than a chod rig is in thick weed. There was,
I hate the bloody chod rig.
I do too.
I rarely use a chod rig.
So yeah, me too.
Yeah,
it's because I get blip, blip. First time I use it, blip, blip. Yeah, that was on cops actually, and I had 2 days in a row. And then, out of desperation, I tight lined with the rod tips over, and I got the rod pulled out. Yeah, I think you get so many aborted takes on that.
Yeah, it's ineffective, isn't it?
It's a really ineffective rig.
Yeah.
To answer you, I'd put a PVA bag out with the hook bait only in the bag for the crumb, with the lead off the line.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in that sort of situation, I mean, I had that sort of situation. I've had it loads of times with Dave. One session on Stone Acres. Wind had changed. It was going up to the top end away from the cafe. Fish were showing up there. Me and Dave both moved up there, and there was fish showing. So
you didn't know there was any spots.
Didn't know any spots. So all I did, I just made the usual, the extended deep blowback rigs, over length hook length. You know, 18-inch 2-foot hook length. Just cast it straight out, and if I got any sort of drop, I just left it at that, and then just stick some baits.
It's fishing and blind, isn't it? But yeah, you know, it's kind of works. So I'll tune the PVA bag to the lead. Yeah, fill it up, not punch it, and basically the size PVA bags I use, full of crumb with 4 ounce lead. You can feel it just slowly coming down. You know, and if it's a firm bomb, you just feel it boom, touch down. And I've fished that without knowing what's out there, the weed or anything, and I get bites on it.
Yeah.
You know, so I suppose it's slowly settling because the lead's not going down too quick. It's not burning the weed.
I'd forgotten about that rig, but we spoke about it quite recently. Rene, the German rep for Nash, Rene, he had a fish out of church when all the fish were in this near corner near the pump, and it was quite weedy about 6-8 weeks ago. And he only fished a night when he was up here meeting you, and he caught one straight away doing exactly that. He called it a parachute rig. So he's basically used a 2-foot hook link. He's put the rig only with some pellet in the bag, not punctured it. He said you had to, I asked him about it actually, how he sets it. He said you basically have to not puncture it, but there's a balance between stopping the bag melting while it's floating.
You've got enough lead, so as soon as it hits the surface, it starts sinking. Otherwise, you say the bag punches before it comes down.
Yeah, because you don't want the bag coming off before the whole thing's hit the top of the weed or whatever. What he said, you did do that with the right amount of PVA foam. He put nuggets in the bag, so he put his pellet in, and he said you just needed 2 nuggets of foam inside
the bag,
don't punch it, and that's the perfect light and weight balance, if you know what I mean, for it not to just all melt at the top and then your rig fall down on its own. But yeah, that's a great way to fish into weed that I always forget about. Just a long hook link and just putting the rig only in a PVA bag.
Done it.
And they call it parachute because it comes down slowly.
But if
you put some foam, you know, some nuggets in it.
Yeah, but getting back to what you said before, what we've been talking about recently is another syndicate water that I fished couple of years ago.
And do we want to put this out, this one?
Well, I'm not going to say no syndicates or no names.
No, I'm in the rig.
Well, there was an angler on there who 2 springs on the trot, he outfished everyone.
Yeah.
He's quite an old guy, been around, you know, very experienced. Watercraft was 100% his observation more than anything else. He was the only guy on there that I found moving to the spot before, moving around to that swim where the fish were nutting before. He was getting there before me, but he was catching a lot of fish. And I was like, obviously, I was thinking, you know, why is he getting so many bites? And then one day, when he was, I don't know where he was, he'd gone to the shop or he was visiting someone else, but his rods were in there. I happened to wander past his rods while the rigs were
to go and check
hooked,
it out.
Were hooked on the butt ring. You know, I couldn't help but just have a quick peep. And at first glance, his rigs looked completely normal. He just looked like a normal, say, 12-inch hook length, you know, with a lead click semi-fixed. But then when I really looked, what he actually had was he had like a helicopter-type rig that was obviously allowing the hook length, which was like a Teddy Hearn-style stiff rig. It was allowing that hook length to fly back up the line on the cast. He was setting it to come back, I don't know, 6, 8, 10 foot up. And he was fishing the weed. It was early spring. The weed was really, really tight to the deck. He was casting it out. The hook length was flying back, and that was all settling completely on top of the weed. And he was catching 3 or 4 times the amount of fish than everybody else. But if he was stood in his peg and he was playing the fishing, and he was about to land it, it just looked like, because obviously it all pulled straight back down.
Looked like a normal rig.
It just looked like a normal rig. Yeah,
we missed. So we're talking about the parachute rig, which I think is fantastic, but Roger's just told a story of a guy who was catching more than everybody else, and he went and sneaked to look at his rigs when he wasn't looking.
Yeah, he was catching 3 or 4 early spring on 2 consecutive years. He was catching a lot more fish than everybody else, and I happened to one day when he wasn't in his peg, I was walking past, I think it was
going, as you do.
Mm-hmm. And his rigs were hooked onto his butt ring, and it just looked like a normal rig. But when I looked closely, you could see it was like a 12 inch Teddy Hearn style, stiff rig style hook length, but it was helicopter style. And I could see that on the cast of casting it out, it was allowing this hook length to come all the way back up. Fishing it over, it was springtime, really close weed to the deck, fishing areas where, you know, other lads could not get presentations, and he was obviously flying back, he was settling all down, he was getting a really good presentation, he was hooking fish, and then
he's found a way to use a normal rig,
yeah,
a chod,
normal rig
basically,
as a chod. And if he was in his peg and he was landing a fish, it just looked like a normal rig because it all pulled back down.
Well, that's what we used to do walkwise,
yeah,
and helicopter rig with a very light gripping stop, you whack it out and
it just slid up.
It slid up, you know, the theory was that the force of it going in pulled the stop up in our heads, whether it ever did or not, but we used to fish it really tight lined as well, you know, our rod tips would bounce up and down. I wrote about that in the Carp Sighting Mag actually. But yeah, they definitely work, those sliding helicopter rigs.
Yeah, especially with low level weed like silk and stuff. I was thinking Cromwell, that might have worked really well on there, because it was very hard to find any clear spots on Cromwell, but the weed was low, it was just horrible silkweed on the bottom, but everywhere. And other people used to catch it, I could never really get to grips with it, I like to find spots, but that would have been perfect there, just a helicopter with the bead right at the top of your leader, allowing the rig to come all the way up if it wanted to. It doesn't really matter how deep the weed was in that particular place, so that's just going to plug in and your rig's going to sit on top. I think as I learn stuff, I think past so many past experiences where I would have caught loads more fish if we'd have known about this rig then, or, you know, I mean,
a comment made earlier saying, you know, it was a theme throughout my first book, we're going to water, crack it, go to another one and do something completely fucking different. What's that about? Yeah. No, you're saying, you know, you do something and then you change it. Why?
For no reason, no, when it was working. Although quite often lakes, they pose a different set of problems, don't they, sometimes?
So you think, do they?
Yeah, carp are carp, aren't they?
Or are you just falling over anglers? Sure, I've made that mistake.
Well, on that note, we've done 2 hours of rigs. Unless there's something we haven't touched about the mechanics of hooking. I mean, we have to keep something secret, right? We can't give all the information away.
Well, I'm going back to my peg now to cast the new experimental one out. I'll see how I get on with that one.
Listen to the Carpcast on iTunes and subscribe through the podcast app on your iPhone or iPad. For Android users, find us on the Stitcher Radio app. Go to Google Play and download Stitcher Radio for podcasts. Add us to your playlist and click listen to hear us anytime you like. Don't forget to enable offline listening if you wish to save your data on the bank. We're also available on the SoundCloud app under the Carpcast, or check our website at www.thecarpcast.com. Remember, listening through an app will recall where you were up to when you get that screamer, or you could always make a whip. The fish, of course.
So I hope you enjoyed that, getting deep on the rigs. Again, if you've got any listeners' questions or anything that sprung up about that, or anything you want to ask, then by all means, fire away. Sure, Kevin will be back on in a few weeks as well to answer anything if you've got any questions about stuff that he said, as will Roger. There's something on the notes I glossed over here before, Mark, but I saw on the internet, is a picture Crowey put up of a very large common that he caught recently, like was it 38, 39 or something?
Yeah, I think it was 38 when Crowe caught it, and it was I managed to track it down along with a big mirror, also a upper 30 called Pinky. I managed to track him down where they lived. Crowe called them the Forgotten Common, and tracking it down wasn't easy, because I was, when I seen Crowe with these fish, I'm thinking, why the hell don't I know about those? So, anyway, I found out I was, short of getting a ticket going on there. I'm thinking, that's close enough for overnighters. And now otters have eaten it. They've eaten the common, and having nobody walk around the lake and seeing it, there's no way it'll ever get fenced. And I think it's just lost to them. It's another, real old, for the area, history fish. They do date really well back. We had a brief chat with Crowe at the Carp Society doing, he's got pictures of it, via Paddy Webb from, around the 80s and earlier, the fish were doubles.
Wow. What a shame. So what does that mean for you this year? Are you
back to the drawing board. Right. I was quite looking forward to that. I was, I've been looking at, JRC do some cracking little 10-foot rods, so I was going to get some of those in the armoury and... I was really looking forward to it because that's my style of fishing.
Mm.
But obviously, not now.
What a shame! I'll tell you something ironic that I thought about. There was a chap, I forget his name now, I apologise, but saw him make a post on Facebook. It was a typical end of the year post. Been a tough year for him. He did all the courses and got the licence to actually trap otters. Probably thinking it'd be a good business venture, whatever. He's obviously spent some time and money doing this, and he thought, do you know how many inquiries I've had from fisheries to help them trap otters? And he was like, none, not one. What does that tell you? We all know they're a problem, and people aren't willing to spend money to or are apathetic about or maybe they're just not paying enough attention to the fishery to know that they've actually got otters on there in the first place. I don't know, but. I was quite surprised when he said, he's done all this and nobody was really interested.
Yeah, well, do people know that he's got this ticket and he can actually do it for him? I think most people should know, fishery owners at least, should know that this law is now in place, that if you've got a fenced fishery and an otter is trapped inside, you can legally trap it and relocate it.
Yeah, there's a few things going on. I saw this post. I didn't know this guy had this thing. But if I owned a fishery and I had an otter problem, the first thing I'd do is Google who can sort it out for me. And I'm sure this chap, if he has started a business, I'm sure there's a list somewhere of people that are licensed.
Definitely, you'd have thought. And if I was like, this fellow with this, I think I'd have sent an email out just introducing myself and put myself out there. Getting it now because, you know as well as I do, it's otters. You cannot give them an inch, And this is another thing I want to mention. I've seen on my travels. I've seen quite a few otter fences, from one end of the scale, the likes one that Andy Stafford put around the wool pack, which is the best, most professional otter fence I've ever seen, to other so-called otter fences that ain't going to stop a damn Labrador, never mind an otter. So it's, you just cannot mess around. Your fences have got to be secure, have got to be, have that tilt over the top to stop them climbing them, and or electrified. And not just that, they've got to be maintained as well. I've been chatting to the lads who have a Majestic Pool, a cracking fishery out near Beverley, but it's right next to the River Hull, which has had a stupid amount of otters released onto it. And they've got a cracking fence all the way around there, but they've still got an otter in for a short period. It was just a maintenance issue. I mean, it's still there, the fish is still there, the fishery is still there, and has been doing some cracking fish this winter. But it just goes to show you cannot mess around. Your fences have got to be good. They've got to be sunk into the ground. They've got to be tilted over the top. And one thing I've seen is not just your fence, but on your gates. Your gate is, you cannot trust people, not just anglers, but it's people in general, to close the gate after them 100% of the time. So just put a great big spring on your gate. And also, you've got to have some sort of like something hard in the ground under the gate. You can't bury a gate. So I know, like Andy at the Woolpack, he's got like a buried railway sleeper or a, you know, sideways on under the gate. When you shut the gate, there's, you know, maybe a centimetre gap, if that. So.
Yeah, Andy did it properly, didn't he? He did it.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, the lads who did it were great lads as well. I remember having a conversation with them. You know, and they were saying once the otters know that the food source is in there, even when it's fenced up, you know, they've seen tracks where otters have just circled the fishery via the fence, you know, done numerous laps looking for that little glitch in the matrix where they can sneak in.
There are options out there these days, and fortunately they all cost money, but fish aren't particularly cheap either. Not to mention the 10-15 years you're going to have to invest to get it back to somewhere near to where it was before the otters came in. So it is an issue now. I think if you own a lake, you're going to be very aware of otters, and you can't ignore it anymore. I think you have to do stuff. There's, you know, things like the MBO project out there to help. There are grants now from, is it from the EA or the Angling Trust? Remember Rob talking about it on his last podcast. There is a figure of money. It might be as much as £500,000, £400,000 seems to ring a bell, something like that, that has actually been allotted to help private fisheries, commercial fisheries, club waters, everything. You can apply for a grant to otter fence that. I don't know how widely known that is, but there is money there you can apply for. So there's literally no excuse for not protecting your stock these days, like no excuse. I know it's impractical on some places, maybe you don't own all the land, or you know, it's got open access and stuff, but I'm sure there's places that it is very difficult, but you know, there is stuff out there now that can help you. So yeah, so there we go. Before we wrap up today then, I noticed John Mack give us a few winter fishing tips, didn't he? We might as well do that before we go, since it's still winter.
Yeah, it's very much still winter. I've just had, well, I went for a couple of nights this week myself, and I fished one and just thought, what the hell am I doing here? You know, the lake had not done a bite for well over a month, and it was cold. I was getting a bit of a sniffle and just didn't feel motivated. I went on, but maybe if I'd have read John Mack's tips. So here's it. I quite like these as well. They're more practical, and you cannot knock John Mack's pedigree of winter fishing. He says, put your milk and water bottle under your bed at night, or drape your coat over the top of them when you get in your bag. Tea in the morning is a must. Coffee for me, but it is certainly a must, a hot drink. If using a petrol Coleman, make sure it's full but switched off before you go to sleep. If you catch a fish during the night, you'll have a freezing wet hands and you'll struggle to get your stove to refill it when wanting to warm your hands up. Well, practical stuff this. Don't use a lighter with a flint, use one that clicks and lights. Again, I've previously struggled to light my stove when wanting a warm up due to freezing cold wet hands. This simple item could save you freezing your knackers off. In fact, it could save you your life. Maybe a tad dramatic, but you get the point.
Save you your life. Yeah, it's true. My Coleman actually gave up. I bought one of the black, originally early Colemans, and it was mint, and didn't go fishing for a couple of weeks, and now I can't really get it going.
You should have took Uncle Kev's advice and got the Red X.
I did, yeah.
I remember that one. I'm finishing the Colemans. Have you ever had one where you've... I've had this happen to me a couple of times before, ones in the past, where it's starting to get a bit clogged up, where you've not put any Red X treatment in. You pump it, and then you pump it some more. You've still only got a little fluff of a flame coming out the top, and then it all starts squirting flames out from underneath the top.
That's exactly what's happened to mine. Couldn't really get much of a thing out the top. It was just like lighting a tiny yellow flame, but because of all the pressure, it was pushing it out the bottom, and then the whole thing set on fire.
Yeah, I've done that a couple of times. I've seen, do you have a mate of mine? He's called Mark Hogg. He's a cracking fella, you know, proper, he's a true Yorkshireman. He put a picture up the other day of his Coleman where he'd done exactly that with the looks of it. Had flames everywhere, and he's just booted it out of his bivvy. Had a bit of a close call. I think he singed his eyebrows, maybe.
Winter tips off John Mack. Thank you very much, John. He is somebody that relishes the winter. He loves it, doesn't he? So, and he normally has a few fish. He's had a couple of fish this winter that I've seen as well. So, yep, shout out to Johnny Mack. I think there's actually two places left. Are now
is a carp cast trip to John Mack's Lake with John Mack and myself and you, if you want to come, Mark, in March. If you go on the Carpcast website, you can, in the shop there, you can see, you can pay, I think you got to pay like 50% deposit now, which is hard price. I think it's $350 for the week. Drive and survive, got to get yourself there. We advise you not to book your ferry just yet, because just in case, like, the lakes are frozen or whatever and we have to refund the money or postpone it or something. But it's 2 weeks before the Northern Anglia show, so it's the middle of March it is. If you're interested in going, there's just two places left. www.thecarpcast.com, and have a look in the shop there and you can see, along with all the other stuff. If you fancy some other holidays, we vipcarpholidays.com. If you get over there, we're looking at holidays with a difference. We've got a villa with a swimming pool and facilities, sleeps 8 people, with its own private stretch of land on the river lot. It's owned by Jim Lightfoot, angler extraordinaire of the Abroads. He's been fishing it all winter while he's been decorating and doing some stuff on the place to get it ready for opening in, I think it opens March or April. Some really good prices if you want to book early in the year. It's in the south of France, so it's really, really warm down there. You know, it is nice and warm from early doors. Red hot in the summer. I think July and August is full now, but there are plenty of other weeks available. And obviously we're taking bookings for 2018 as well. It's fantastic. As I said, you get the villa. There's loads of bedrooms and stuff in there. There's like table tennis tables. And there's a nice pool outside. You can get on there and have a look, and it's absolutely fantastic. Jim can be a guide for you. He's got a boat you can also hire. I mean, you get boats to fish the river as part of the price, but he has a cruiser where you can actually do a, you know, live on the boat for a week if you wanted to. Just go on your own, maybe have Jim as a guide, or if you're an experienced boat angler, he'll rent it to you to use with yourself and a friend. Saint Amand is on there as well, which is the cracking farmhouse with a 4.5 acre lake, sleeps 10 people, that we advertised last year on the Carpcast. There's only a few weeks available for 2017 now. I think there's like 9 or 10 weeks available, but again, if you get on vipcarpholidays.com, you can have a look on there. And obviously we're taking bookings, 2018 starting to fill up there as well. But that's 4.5 acre private lake, stuff full of fish to £50. It's like 10 fish a day type fishing. It's got all sorts of small fish in there. It's perfect to take the family, the kids. As is the Riverlot venue, that's got all species as well. Both are really good places to go on a family holiday. There's also a traditional big fish French water on there as well that you can hire the entire lake. It's called Casson Lac, and get on the website and you can have a look. That's pretty much it for this week, Mark. I think we should wrap it up there. We'll be back next week. Some more listeners' questions. If you've got any questions, then by all means, fire them over to us. And have fun.
Yeah, and you're going fishing next week?
I think I'm going to fish Sunday. The weather's looking all right over the weekend. It's like sort of sixes, sevens minimum, and double figures in the day. And pressure's not great, but I think I'm going to go. I mean, we've only got a few weeks to actually fish Church and Cops over the winter, so need to kind of make the most of it, even though the weather's crap. We might not get this opportunity ever again, so I kind of need to go.
Yeah, I certainly see that. And if you do go, I'm interested to see how your stinky spot's going.
Yeah, well, there were some people did the charity, the bidding thing, where the KHV fundraising thing. Yeah, some people did that, and I think they booked a trip over the Christmas period. I know fish were showing, because I saw them post on Facebook, the lads that were fishing it, so I don't think anything was caught. I've not heard, anyway. That means, you know, they probably found that spot, because it's a pretty obvious one, so I don't know if more bait's gone on it, but yeah, I would have been interested to see. I mean, I'll certainly let you know if it's still smelling or not.
Yeah, and if you can do what I said last time, you know, stick your GoPro and even just take a picture of it, we can have a... You can post it up, have a look.
Yeah, that's a good idea. And don't forget cold water recordings. Get that cold shower and give us all a laugh. I'll start one off this week as well.
You know, you're going to get sued if someone does it, slips and falls over.
Well, if you can't get in your own shower without falling over, then that isn't my fault.
You don't have to have a cold shower at your own risk.
Yeah. In fact, I might just... I'm going to have a shower in a minute. I'm going out tonight. So forget that, because by the time you hear this, you will have already heard my cold shower. So yeah, get your own in. And that's it from us. Catch you next week.
Okay, the shower is on. I'm about to get under it and turn it to cold and see what happens.
Oh, I must be getting used to it. Oh my word. I don't have to give you 30 seconds off. Oh, I see now. I'm dizzy. Oh my god, that's it.
Can't take any more. Oh, right, your turn.
Check out the website at www.thecapcast.com. There you'll find extra content, merchandise, and lots more to support the show, including our entire back catalogue of free offerings.